The curse of the devil. Exorcism, a sacrifice. Blessing or bestiality. The curse of the devil. Satan in control of the body and the mind.
My love will destroy the creation. I swear that you'll find it.
Hello and welcome to episode 30 of the Nashy Cast. I am Rod Barnett.
I'm Troy Gwynn.
And I decided to change the way I say that just for a second. Oh, and if you heard
the way you did it. Yeah, we've got a third.
We have a guest. It's true. You will if you occasionally hear a meow in this episode, that would be Katie the cat, who has a number of different noises she makes, and Lord only knows which one she will make at us this evening. This is the first episode we've recorded in a new location now that I've moved.
We were in our palatial new studio, which our overwhelming success from this podcast has enabled us to move up.
Cue moving on up.
And moving on up. I know. In memory of...
Sherman Hemsley. It's our new recording studio.
Mm-hmm.
The only downside...
I'm not behind the bed anymore. I'm not behind
that's
in
true,
the corner
you're
behind
not.
The bed.
But you are, you know, being stared at and meowed at by a cat.
I know. Katie's going to be a guest here, I'm sure. She's enjoying having some extra company over here.
Anybody who will scratch her and or provide a lap makes her ecstatic.
We're going to have to get her and Flex together, I think. And
I know. Yeah, I don't know. Well, I don't know. That would be... Cats are weird critters.
They are.
You can never tell how they're going to act or react. But welcome to episode number 30, where tonight... We venture into the 21st century for Paul Nashy this time around. Our first venture into the 21st century.
Well, you know, with a bigger budget studio, we figured we had to do a really big, big budget film, you know, to start out with here.
Oh, my. That's the cruel things that you say, Troy. Okay.
No.
Tonight, folks, we're doing 2004's Tomb of the Werewolf. A film that brings us not only into the 21st century, but into the rather fetid swamp of direct-to-video horror films, or in this case, direct-to-video softcore pornography.
Yeah, let's call it what it is.
let's do that. But before we dive into the film, let's get the preliminaries out of the way. First of all, thank you very much for listening, and thank you for coming to listen to us month in and month out. We are always thrilled to know that there are people out there who really enjoy this show and that really can't wait for the next one to pop up in the feed. Once again, if you'd like to participate in the show, you can email us at nashycast@gmail.com. You can send us messages via carrier pigeon, carrier cat, if you can strap it. Flaming arrow will work. It's very true. If he's best to write on asbestos sheeting at that point.
Yeah, that's
right. You can reach us at the email, nashycast@gmail.com, and or on our Facebook page. Post something there. Let us know about it. I did post recently on the Nashycast page that this whole film is available on YouTube in chunks, so you can watch it for free right there at your computer.
You can call it convenient or you can call it a crime, but this film is more available than many Paul Nashy films.
I think I'm going to go with crime.
I think so too, but you can get it, but you can get it used very cheap, and as Rod said, you can just go on YouTube. I found YouTube is just such an amazing thing. I've set this...
quite a resource.
I've set this crazy, crazy like goal for myself, and it's one that I'm luckily not in any hurry to complete. But I received as a gift from my awesome brother, older brother Pack, last Christmas, one or the other. I can't remember. He got me that incredible Bill Warren.
Keep watching the skies.
The new edition that is an amazing book. And I've actually thought of trying to start with 1950 and watch every film that came out in the 50s in the order they were, you know, in the chronological order.
Some of those are hard to find.
Yeah, and some of them are hard to watch. I mean, if you get to considering I started with the first one, The Flying Saucer, which, as he quickly points out...
it's not a very good film.
No, but he had to put it in there because it's the first film that came out in 1950, and it was one of the first films that really kind of responded to this Flying Saucer phenomena, even though it never acknowledges at any point in the film or even brings up the possibility that the flying saucer might be from outer space. It's, of course, a...
Really?
It's, of course, a...
Oh, that's right. I remember that.
It's something that, of course, they're fighting the commies to get to quick, you know, first. Yeah. And anyway, yeah, yeah. So, but what made me think of this was talking about YouTube was the second film on the list was proving to be even harder. It's a British comedy called The Perfect Woman. And I went around and around trying to find it. It's had no DVD release, not even in Britain. But then I just finally thought, why not just check YouTube? And sure enough, the whole damn thing's out there, and you know, and same as so, YouTube's gonna make my job a little, make my goal a little easier to, you know. But
wow, do you know what the count is on the science fiction films of the 50s?
I've been afraid to look and see what I've set for myself, you know. So
gotta be over 100.
Oh, it's a bunch. Of course, you know. Needless to say, you know, a lot of them all have already seen, but there's going to be tons that I haven't. And I thought, like, well, this would be kind of a fun thing to just, you know, do, take it my own pace. You know, I may complete it when I'm 80 or something, but...
who knows?
Yeah, but it'll be fun to kind of read about the film, go out and see it, and just kind of see, watch the decade unfold in chronological order, I think would be kind of a neat thing to do.
You have this ability, man, to set yourself a goal, have this... this long list of a particular genre or something like that. Like when you got that Mill Creek Warrior set with all the peplum stuff, all the sword and sandal films, and you force marched your way through that whole thing.
All 50 films.
I can't watch the same kind of film back to back to back. I can watch two or three of them maybe over the course of a couple of days, and I'm okay. Mm-hmm. But I flit around and watch so many different types of movies.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that is, if you watch the list I post every month of what I watched in the previous month. It's just this insane back and forth of, you know, I went to see Snow White and the Huntsman and then watched a, you know, a 1940s mystery programmer that nobody and their grandmother has ever heard of. But, you know, Turner Classic Movies showed it and by God, I got to watch it. So, you know, there's just no telling what I'll watch from film to film to film, and that's kind of the way I like it. It's variety is the spice of life in a way, but I'm kind of in awe that that's a skill set that you have. Yeah. I can't do it, man. But oh Lord, I guess we better wrap this conversation up and tell people that we're going to take a quick break. Mm. We'll come right back and we'll dive headlong into Tomb of the Werewolf. Remember, if you want to get hold of us, please do. And we'll be back in a few minutes.
And we have a Facebook page. I don't know if we mentioned that or not.
I mentioned the Facebook page. We can mention it again. We have a Facebook page for the NashyCast.
Cool.
And we'll be back in just a second, and we will dive headlong into this film.
And now, meet the star of our show. Symbol of a treat that quality made famous. America's most famous ice cream treat, Eskimo Pie. Creamy, delicious ice cream made even more exciting with smooth, rich chocolate coating. And wearing the label of quality known the world over. Eskimo Pie, the treat you know is tops because it carries its pledge of quality right on the back of the bag. Be sure you save the bags for valuable premiums. Get famous Eskimo Pie at our refreshment stand now. It's America's anytime taste treat. Finest ice cream, finest chocolate. It's delicious.
Friends and neighbors, we come to you tonight not to bury Nashy, but to praise him. But we intend to bury this movie.
Well, we should probably start before we get into anything, about talking about the man, the myth, the icon, the institution that is Fred Olin Ray, who directed this film.
You zigged there. That's pretty good. Fred Olin Ray. Director, producer, writer. Somewhat ad hack, not me, although it's tempting. Fred Olen Ray seems to have at times taken it upon himself to produce as many films as humanly possible within a single year. He has actually produced films from beginning to end as fast as possible on a bet. This is true. The question becomes, are his films worth seeing? Is it worth worrying about when you see his name? Should you fear it, or should you grin and glee? Does it add an extra shot of joy?
You know, first of all, I will say this. The man has 125 films to his credit. Now, before getting anything else about him, whatever else your opinion on him, you got to give him props for that, because making films just seems to me like a really hard thing to do. And let you know, and if you're doing anything other than just pointing a camera at a wall filming, if you're doing, regardless of whether the films are, you know, whatever budget you have to work with, even if the films aren't very good, if you're doing such things as coordinating cast, you know, setting up locations, using sets, using special effects, even if they're bad special effects, I mean, it's like, if you're going to all that, it just seems to me like it is a really, truly hard thing to pull off. And so, you know, if the man's done 125 films, you know, you got to first at least acknowledge, like, you know, give him props for that before you get into, you know. And another thing that, of course, that he's kind of known for, I mean, you know, he always seems to me like he'd be a great guy just to hang out and talk films with.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You know,
he's clearly a movie fan.
And he's kind of known for giving last gasp to, you know, to a lot of, he loves the horror stars, he loves the horror movies.
Yeah.
He's known for bringing in a lot of actors who are, you know, on a slump in their career or kind of forgotten, or, you know, the people that he's admired, you know, that he's given some roles to during down times.
Whether, and the argument could be put forth that he's essentially using their name when they're, you know, cheap.
When they need, yeah, sure.
To, you know, enhance his low-budget films,
yeah,
because you can slap a name on it, and then it'll probably sell better to a certain audience. But
that's not new to exploitation. That's been going on for
That's pretty standard. But of the films that I've seen by Fred Olen Ray, I've not particularly enjoyed any of them.
Mm-hmm.
I've not some of them. I think I've probably seen a little more than a half a dozen of them over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never thought any of them were particularly good at all. Some of them are a little less irritating than others.
Yeah, I think Scalps was actually kind of interesting, you know. It's actually got some qualities to it there.
The thing you get into is that I'm not a big fan. But you can't fault the guy for making a living the way he's made it, because he produces these films on a low enough budget and to guarantee a return on investment. And, you know, more power to him. They're not my cup of tea in general, which, I mean, hey, I've got a pretty broad range of the type of film that I like. I mean, you have to hunt pretty hard to find a type of movie that I don't like. Michael Bay. But, in general, I'm a big fan of I feel like I should be a bigger fan of his work, except that every time I see one of his films, it bores the shit out of me.
Sure. Well, you tend to think like, wow, this film has so many elements that I should enjoy, but my enjoyment just isn't registering here in a lot of cases there, because a lot of them are very tedious and very
tedious. That's a good word. That's a word that's going to pop up again and again in a discussion of this film, by the way. Mm. Even though it's insanely short. Did you clock this movie?
75 minutes, folks, before the credits. 75 minutes with 7 minutes of credits.
Seven full
slow tracking credits, but we're getting way ahead. But that does remind me that we should warn you that we are going to be discussing this film to the closing credits, including the ending, so we will be spoiling it. And so you should definitely watch the film before you listen to our podcast, because we are going to be giving away lots and lots of stuff.
Oh, yeah, we'll be discussing the living crap out of this film. So, I would like to say that I think Fred Olen Ray may actually be the filmmaker with the most number of titles in his filmography that use the word bikini. Bikini Chain Gang, Bikini Escort Company, Ghost in a Teeny Bikini, Bikini Girls from the Lost Planet. We need to check Guinness. We need to check the Guinness book, because I am pretty sure he's got that particular record locked up. Hello, Katie. How are you doing? Yes, those are my notes. Quit quit doing what you're doing to my notes, which is, you know, I'll scratch you later. We're podcasting. Anyway, folks, Tomb of the Werewolf, 2004, a DTV, direct-to-video film adventure. Now, pretty
this
much anybody.
Was the, I guess this was the last appearance of Waldemar Daninsky.
And I am going to scream at you, fuck you, fuck you, fuck you. So I cannot call this a Waldemar Daninsky film. Let's get this out of the way. They use the name, and
I would argue that there was some familiarity with. I think they tried to make a Waldemar Daninsky film. I emphasize tried. I do feel like they. I felt like they had watched some of his movies and were trying to do a Daninsky-esque story combined with a Cinemax, you know, Cinemax After Hours, you know, kind of, but, you know, they tried. That's my operative
word.
Well,
they definitely had seen some Daninsky films because of all the elements they use. When you have a character, when you have Elizabeth Bathory, or Bathory, as they pronounce it in this.
I know, yeah.
Then you have, you know, and you've got her being the an antagonistic character toward a werewolf named Waldemar Daninsky. Okay, yeah. But it...
you can see if they contacted him and told him some of these elements, you know, were going in there, you know, that he'd be all about it, you know, if they told him, you know, we're going to have this, you know, the but ancient curses, the Elizabeth Bathory, you know, that he'd be just like, you know, oh, this sounds great, you know.
I'm sure when he saw the, you know, the chintzy set design and the lousy production values, it had to. I mean, not that, you know, his films in the 70s ever had incredible production value or a whole lot of budget, but wow, this one really shows what you can get away with if you skimp on, you know, money.
Yeah.
But we'll see.
Yeah.
All right, folks.
I imagine when you just saw the wig he was going to have to wear, probably that in itself was maybe enough.
We're going to talk wig. Wonderful wigs. We're going to talk facial hair, too. Yeah, so. Yeah. All right.
Okay, here we go. We begin, and absolutely, we have no idea where the hell time we are when we start this
movie. Out in the middle of the woods somewhere with some not particularly sexy or attractive redhead tied to a tree. Another woman comes up to her and begins to threaten her with a knife and starts talking a bunch of shit. Essentially, it turns out that this woman is Elizabeth Bathory, or Bathory.
Bathory, as they call her.
Bathory. She's tied this chick to a tree to make a sacrifice to Satan. Although I'm never really sure. Anyway, apparently.
Well, yeah, we'll get into the whole convoluted just what the hell is going on with.
Oh, God, I have to relive the convoluted plot of this fucking thing. Oh, Jesus. Okay, here we go. I'm strong, man. I'm good. I can do this. It's like a deadlift. I can do this. I can stretch my muscles. And I'll be a better man for this. All right. She says. She's thinking about actually having her way with the redhead.
Oh, no, I'm thinking like maybe I won't give you to say. Maybe I will. Maybe I won't. I don't know.
Master shouldn't have all the fun. And then, oh Lord, then we have Satan show up in the chintziest CGI. Explosion of sad CGI.
They love their explosions in this film. We're going to get some great explosions.
Well, he shows up and he looks exactly what you think Satan would look like if you had no budget and you knew a guy who was maybe about 6'1"
and had a goatee.
Well,
and I love the fact that he's kind of like he's perpetually smelling something foul through this whole, you know, that I think he's trying to give like what he thinks is a sinister sneer, and it more just looks like he's. Yeah, like he's smelling a polecat or something, a dead polecat through the whole scene.
I just referred to him as SS, Shitty Satan. it's pretty bad. So we've got she summons Satan up, and then a super cheesy CGI effect. He appears and he's all Satan-y at her, and apparently he just decides to curse her because
reason he's disappointed. I'm not disappointed. Really sure why.
I don't know. It's to further the plot, and I'll do the air quotes there.
The
plot. And so he curses Elizabeth Bathory to have to bathe in the blood of her victims to keep her youth.
She doesn't take this very badly.
I know. At first she's like, oh no, and then wait, I can do that.
Oh, wait, yeah, I can handle bathing in naked girls' blood. Okay, I can do
that. Okay, first things first. I love the fact that the only clue we have as to a time period here is the extremely lame inclusion in the dialogue of these and vows. which is...
Folks, there's a reason why, you know, nobody ever really attempts to do that. There's a reason why when they made, like, say, the latest Thor movie, why they just probably nixed that real early on, you know, say, like, we can have otherworldly sounding dialogue without having to put in the these and thous and the dots and that, because it never works. It just doesn't work.
It can work, but it can only work if what you're doing is kind of meant to be kind of a stagey or a kind of a set piece away from something else that you're, you know, some other part of the story. If it's being presented as something else, or if that is the entire piece, if that's the entire piece, and the piece was written at a time when that was language.
Yeah, and also if the characters don't step in and out of it from one line to the next. Did you notice that?
Yes, I noticed that. It's very clear that that the actors had a little bit of trouble occasionally with fitting that dialogue in, and I'm sure that, you know, you blow it once or twice, and it's just like, to hell with it, move on.
Got more setups to do, let's go.
Satan, you know, blinks off there after cursing her, and in another CGI.
We get a nice explosive fiery credits, more explosion. Yeah.
So, first she cuts the redhead's throat and smears blood all over herself. And I'm guessing, I've always thought that if you're going to be Elizabeth Báthory and have to bathe in virgin's blood, I'm expecting you to, like, dangle the body over you and cut the throat and have the blood.
You're supposed to fill a tub at some point with it.
Not just slice a throat and, like, rub it on your face like it's makeup or something.
Well, as we'll eventually see in Night of the Werewolf, I mean, if nobody knew how to film that better than Paul Naschy, you knew. Yeah. So even at this point, Naschy's probably thinking, like, are you kidding me? This is what we're getting here?
Dude, let's be blunt. Naschy was nowhere near this scene when it was shot.
That's true. Oh, yeah.
We'll get into just how little participation Mr. Naschy had in this particular production as we go along.
Pains me already to think of it. Yeah. But let's talk about Elizabeth Báthory for a second. She is not unknown to us, to male fans of horror.
Female flesh.
Yeah.
She is played by Michelle Bauer. Mm-hmm. And she began her film career in X-rated films.
Mm-hmm.
And then became kind of a scream queen, or actually she did become a scream queen.
She was probably, I mean, when you think of kind of, I guess to me it was sort of the trio, the scream triumphant there was pretty much, I guess, Linnea Quigley, Brink Stevens, and Michelle Bauer. They were kind of the three reigning queens of you know, 80s and 90s horror movies there.
And the thing I would have to say is that... For what is required of her, she's not bad at what she needs to do.
You know, she chews the scenery pretty nicely, you know, which she's called to do.
And I've seen her in more than a few. I can never remember how many. I saw a couple of those really sad end of career Jess Franco shot on video production she was in.
Yeah.
Which all sucked, but at least you know, it's kind of neat to know that. In his declining years, Franco was still able to get things together and put together movies like, you know, Lust for Frankenstein, Marry a Cookie, and The Killer Tarantula. They were terrible films. I don't think they were good in any way, shape, or form. But, you know, she was working with him on those, and she was turning out, you know, 5, 6, 7 films a year, because we're talking about low-budget, straight-to-video stuff that, you know, was you know, you pump it out. I mean, it's not as if... anybody thinks that this is going to be some kind of, you know, classic or even something that somebody's going to think about ever watching a second time.
Mm-hmm. But with all but she has some of the film. She has some of the best moments in this film here, as far as just, you know, whatever few there are. You know, I mean, she gets into the role. She has fun with the role. So
and that honestly, for this type of film, that's something that I think is required. And it's a good thing to actually have there.
Mm-hmm.
She does as good a job as I really think you could expect, and I'm pretty sure there are a couple of places where, you know, one more take with maybe a little direction would have turned it out a little bit better. But
yeah, like you said, you're not going to get too many takes in this.
I'm not going to go into the guy who played Lucifer, because that's
I think that was his only. I think he had like 2 credits or something to it.
I don't know, but the film then takes us to modern day, and we're introduced to Melanie Charles.
Mm-hmm.
She's a girl reporter, or actually, she's kind of a Inside Edition type show,
right?
Journalist.
It's called Current Mysteries. Current Mysteries.
She's kind of just an on-screen personality, not really what I would call a journalist. But then again, we're talking about Tame of the Werewolf, so who gives a shit?
Yeah.
It turns out that we're watching her latest report on just weird stuff. That appears to be what Current Mysteries focuses on, which seems to be patterned after like Unsolved Mysteries darn, what was that other show that was like a big syndicated show in the 90s?
Was it Believe It or Not? Or was it, well, I guess Believe It or Not.
Well, there was the Believe It or Not thing, too, but there was another I'm thinking about that I can't remember. Anyway, so obviously patterned after that. She's watching her latest thing with her boyfriend, who's also a producer on the show. Mm-hmm. They kind of threw some not too bad dialogue, give us the gist of their jobs, what they're doing, and the fact that they're a couple. Mm-hmm. They start making out. The phone rings. It is the boyfriend's phone. It's their boss, who's sitting in a bar with a guy, and he wants the boyfriend to come down to the bar and mm-hmm. talk about an idea he has for a new segment for the show.
Mm-hmm.
He says, oh, okay, but he delays long enough to have sex with the girlfriend.
Can, yeah, do some more.
And we have, so we have a little bit more nudity there. So mm-hmm. we had nudity of the nondescript redhead who gets her throat cut at the beginning of the film. And then this is our second set of breasts.
Mm-hmm.
So if those keeping track at home, that would be four. It's like Joe Bob. Right.
Yeah,
keep a count. Four. So, oh God, I don't know that I want to break. I don't know that I want to like step on the copyright of that particular Joe Bob Briggs thing.
That's right.
So,
Tony, I think is the boyfriend's name.
Yes. Tony eventually makes it down to the bar, and is introduced to Robert Daninsky.
Richard Daninsky.
Is it Richard?
Richard, I believe.
Oh shit, you're right. It is Richard Daninsky. My apologies to Richard Daninsky. And he is the last surviving heir of the Daninsky family, mm-hmm. and has just inherited the family estate in Europe. Now, they never get more specific than Europe, actually is kind of a neat little callback to the other Daninsky films, where it rarely gets all that specific. A couple times we know we're in Germany and things like that. But
something Carpathiesque or whatever about it, mm-hmm. but never fully like just narrowing it and nailing it there. So, but yeah,
he's inherited the family estate in this big book that has the family history in it,
mm-hmm.
and there is a legend that they talk about in the book of a family treasure hidden somewhere in the family castle and on the grounds somewhere. He has no idea where it is. He's hunted. But he has an idea that he could employ this show and the people involved in this show to pay him to come and film a segment while they look for the treasure. And if they find the treasure, then the treasure's his. Yay, and they get a segment for their show out of it, and everybody's happy.
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like a good idea.
He also wants to bring along a psychic investigator to help them.
Correct, because, of course, that may be the only way to find it, and of course it'll be that much more theatrical and therefore that much better for the TV show. Mm-hmm. What I love is that the inheritance left him with a big tax debt on the place, and doing this show is the one way to immediately pay off the tax debt and then hopefully even make some money above and beyond it. So I actually like that aspect of it, because it's not hard to identify with somebody who's had this kind of thing dropped in his lap and is like, well, geez, what the hell do I do now?
Yeah.
Reminds me of those stories of people going on game shows and winning cars and then having to pay the sales tax on the car.
Right.
And realizing, oh, Jesus, this thing isn't free.
Yeah, that's the catch there.
All right.
They might not jump around and scream quite as much if they realize that.
Yeah, really. Oh, my God, what? The boyfriend, that would be Tony.
Yeah.
Takes the book back to Melanie and explains the situation to her. And she decides to sit up for a while, reading through the history of the Daninsky family, and find out about what's going on here. And we get our flashback, and this is where we're 14 minutes into the movie, and we finally have
mm-hmm.
Valdemar
the man
Daninsky,
himself,
Paul Naschy. Now,
not looking so good, a little worse for wear. But let's face it, this was just a few years, very few
50s.
Years before his death. You know,
he was in his late 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right? I think he was in his late 50s. Or was it his early 60s?
Might have been more like early 60s by that point.
At any rate, he's up in years, and I will say this. He looks pretty good in general, if you discount the hideous wig that he's wearing.
Yeah.
All right?
The mullet, tandem mullets, yeah.
Yeah, it's, honestly, I think this may have been worn by a prematurely balding heavy metal star, you know, during the 80s or 90s to make sure that the fans thought that he was still hip and sexy. But not just that, he's also, what at first I couldn't tell, but then it becomes very obvious the more you see it. He's wearing fake facial hair too, a mustache and goatee.
Yeah.
And it's it's bad. I don't know what they paid for this, but the novelty shop called and they want their process back. It's bad. We're introduced through flashback as she reads this book to Count Valdemar Daninsky, and we get his backstory, his story. Essentially, he's a happy guy living there in his castle, in love with his wife, but the Black Death is sweeping through the landscape, which gives us a time period.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
His wife becomes ill with it, and of course he's doing all the praying that he can do and trying to find a way to heal her so that she does not die from this hideous disease. When he gets a visit from a woman, he's praying in the his castle's chapel,
mm-hmm.
and gets a visit from this woman dressed in black, and it turns out to be Elizabeth Bathory, and she offers to save his wife, and asks him, "What would you do?" And he says, basically, he would do anything, and she agrees, kisses him, and then, in a strange turn of events, then immediately starts laughing, and he somehow knows that she's fooled him or cursed mm-hmm. him or something.
Yeah, yeah. Somehow knows.
Which really doesn't... I mean, it doesn't make sense the way it kind of... It doesn't matter.
It's odd. It is very strange.
Let's discuss...
Yeah, well,
let's discuss this scene.
What pains thee, Count, that you should find prayer in this humble chapel?
Is my wife ill?
She has the plague.
Yes.
And what would you desire for her? That she be made whole again? And you would do anything to save her?
Anything.
Even to kill thy neighbor?
To save Eleanor. Yes.
Then kiss me with thy lips, and return the breath of life to the one you cherish above all else.
I cannot.
You must, lest Eleanor dies. The decision is yours, but doth require great haste, as even now she lingers on the fingertips of death. Decide, Count, who shall live, who shall die, and who shall be your master.
But...
From that hour on, Valdemar Daninsky's soul was not his own, and he became as one possessed of the spirit of Satan himself.
I don't see how you can read that stuff. It's like all Greek to me.
Well, the F's and S all kind of look alike, but you can muck it out if you try.
Oh, you can. I'm turning in. You coming?
In a minute. I'm dying to find out how this ends.
Well, don't sit up all night. We're going to meet Gilchrist first thing in the morning and get this European shoot underway.
I'll be up in a minute. No, women are. Suckers for a good love story.
Sucker for a good love story.
And, well, you know, and so is Paul Naschy. And one of the things that cracks me up about... it's one thing I say I appreciate that what they try to... You know, these flashbacks... If we thought Paul Naschy was, like, overly... You know, Paul Naschy never pulls back on the romance angle. These things go way
beyond... Or the
beyond
pathos.
The pathos. These things, boy, just have it in spades. The whole, you know, scene with him walking around with Eleanor and them sniffing flowers and all this stuff is like...
It's very much in keeping with the tone of the other Valdemar Daninsky tales.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're going to call this a Valdemar Daninsky tale, this is the only one he didn't write. But it definitely has, I mean, it's definitely written by someone who, and apparently that's Fred Olen Ray,
mm-hmm.
who definitely knew the films.
Yeah.
So at least for the portion of the film that deals mm-hmm. with the Daninsky character, yeah. these flashbacks specifically, mm-hmm. the elements are there that are typical.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good. That's fine. They're not handled particularly well.
No.
But they're the best parts of the film.
Yeah.
Let's be honest.
Yeah.
And as you could probably tell from that clip, other than the hideous thought of that, that somehow somebody thought the line "she lingers on the fingertips of death" was a good line. I, that one, no, it's not. Besides that,
yeah.
You'll notice the reason for including that clip is that you can hear that, first of all, it is Nashie's voice. It is him speaking.
I was going to say, we do actually, it is one of the rare times that we're in this whole course of our podcast, we will hear Paul Nashie speak in
exactly.
his own voice.
It's not dubbing. It's right. definitely him. Mm-hmm. And they shot these scenes with live sound. And there's part of the problem. And you can sense the budgetary, let's just say the threadbare nature of the budget. And production, there are all these ambient noises that don't need to be there. Like,
did you notice the constant crickets through the whole film? You'll notice them on these sound clips up on there.
Not just the crickets, but as he's standing up and turning around, and his arm or leg brushes against the pew in the chapel there, you can hear it, and that shouldn't be there. That needs to be removed because that's just right. distracting and stupid. Mm-hmm. And there seems to have been absolutely no post production sound work, no. attempt to let me work myself back up again to talk about this movie, because that's one of the things that depresses me, is I think Nashie has a total of, and they haven't speaking obviously probably I mean he spoke a little bit of English, but he has less than a dozen words that
is this the end of his dialogue? Does he even get any other dialogue in the rest of the film?
You know, I can't completely remember now.
I'm not so sure that he does.
I've watched this film twice now, and if I had to watch it a third time, I would probably have to kill someone. So I think
in the modern scenes, as we'll get to, I mean, let's face it, most of the time he's cowering hiding behind some post or something watching. Really embarrassing. But we'll get to it.
That's embarrassing enough. But
so anyway, yeah. So we get another great apparently. Another great explosion for whatever reason after she laughs at after she bites Daninsky or curses him. Then apparently that's how she comes and goes, is just some huge roof shattering explosion. CGI explosion.
Hideous white explosion. Oh Lord. Well,
this is why nobody invited Elizabeth Báthory to their parties.
Of course not.
Because you could tear half your roof off by coming in.
That's terrible. So Daninsky goes back to his wife's bedside to wait for the miracle that he's been promised for whatever the hell he's been told that he's going to have to do. And as he's there, the full moon rises, and we have our first werewolf transformation. And we'd just like to say that this is some shitty CGI. This is bad.
I think it's just overall bad makeup. I mean, it's like... Yeah. And I feel like there was the ability to do better, because there's some effects in this film as far as gore effects and stuff that aren't that bad at all. And, you know, but on my notes I even put like, and then Daninsky turns into a Care Bear. You know, that's what I have. It's like,
I noticed
they gave him some drool, so that's kind of keeping in, but there's no reason they had to make, I don't see why they had to make the werewolf makeup that way. I mean, I feel like they could have, I don't know, even with the budget they had and even the people they had doing it, I get the sense that they could have done something better. I don't know why they made this choice, you know.
Well, we're talking about it. I'd love to know what the budget on this thing was. I don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But, we know it was incredibly small.
Does the IMDb give, did they sometimes list budgets for films or not?
Yes, they do.
I wonder if this, Ray may not divulge that kind of, he may keep that secret.
It hardly matters. The thing is, when you get into a discussion of why certain aspects of this film look terrible, it's because they had a limited budget, and that's what you're going to have to put it down to every time. Let's get to the upshot of this. I have some praise here, and I have a backhanded slap. First of all, let's get the plot details out of the way. His first transformation, he turns into the Wolfman or the werewolf, and he kills his wife. He kills his own wife,
mm-hmm.
and then runs out of the house and into the night. First of all, once Daninsky is in El Hombre Lobo costume outfit, whatever you want to call it, it feels like we're looking at Paul Nashie.
It does.
Because he has that. He once again, he's got the... He's been doing this for 40 years at this point, for God's sake. So the man knows how to crouch, how to look around. well, not quite 40 years at this point, but he acts, you know, he's been doing the werewolf thing for a long time, and he looks good doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's neat. It was really, there was a neat thrill that ran up my spine as soon as it happened, because I was hoping, you always hope when you're watching a movie like this for the first time, that there might be a hinge point where, oh, you know, it was terrible up to then, but then this popped and suddenly the rest of the film really kind of flowed, or it went well, or every time you focused on this, it was really good, or this, that, or the other. That doesn't happen with this movie, but that was the moment when I saw him in motion, saw him doing things, where I was like, oh, wow, that feels right. That feels like a lot. That's what I want to see, you know.
Well,
doesn't pan out.
But. Well, but I'm glad you mentioned it, because I had that in my notes, too, because I noticed that. Did you notice, well, it kind of reminded me recently, you know, when we were at Wonderfest, and Bob Burns was there, and, you know, and they showed the great new documentary on the life of Bob Burns and Bob and Kathy. And Bob talks about, you know, of course, Bob is, you know, definitely on up in years. He's had health problems, you know, he has a little trouble getting around now, you know, great. But he talks about, and we've seen before, the time he came to Wonderfest and the Exotic Ones played, and he got out in his Tracy the Gorilla outfit, you know, and he talks about when he puts on that outfit, he's like, you know, half his age again. You know, he's sitting wear it for, you know, hours, and they're always worried before they put it on him, you know, now, you know, be sure and tell us if you start, you know, any minute you start feeling weak or feel you got to come out of the costume. And he puts it, once he puts it on, he's just totally in character, and it's like he's invigorated. And I noticed in this film, it made me think about it, because the scenes with Paul Naschy, he's, you know, he even though, like we said, he looked good for his age, but he's, there's times when he's moving when he looks like he's having a hard time moving, where he's like, he looks like he's not getting around, you know, all that great, like he's in actual physical pain, which made me, at that point, I was wondering if there was going to be somebody else playing the actual werewolf part. But not only is it Naschy, but you're right, there's a great energy to his werewolf scenes, and I wonder if it's almost the same thing. Put him in the makeup, and he's like a young, you know, he's just like a young man again, you know. It's just because there's a great energy to his, despite the bad makeup, there's really, the werewolf scenes are very well done for the most part.
Well, of course, Daninsky's the signature role, and you have to imagine that no matter what the nature of the production, it had to feel good to be doing that.
Oh, yeah.
Because You got to know that, at least in his mind, as long as he's doing that stuff, then there's some energy on screen, there's some forward momentum, there's something there to draw the eye and to make it interesting. That is true. I mean, I think that's the way it is, but, you know, it's the film drops the ball in so many ways from here on out. Not that it hadn't been dropping it up to now.
Yeah, it wasn't exactly hovering above Times Square at this point. No, it was, you know.
It wasn't going for the full dunk. No, it was failing pretty hard.
But we have finally got the werewolf on the screen, and that's always better, even if it's a bad-looking werewolf. Yeah. So I think that what happened, I believe,
that's the end of the flashback.
She's right. Man. She's read, Melanie has now read the whole history of Daninsky. And, and then, I think we immediately cut to where they're actually in Europe, where Tony and Melanie are arriving at the castle.
And, they quickly inform us that the other three crew members have already arrived in front of them, along with all the equipment that they're going to need.
Mm-hmm.
And, we see that Castle Daninsky doesn't really look like a European castle. It looks more like a set
bed and breakfast,
Disney World castle. This is a Disney idea of a European castle, and it turns out that we're not far off. It's in California. That house, God save us, is a house in California, up in the Hollywood Hills. It's a castle that somebody built up there, and it's generally a private residence, but you can rent it out, and apparently, you know, film companies do rent it out.
Oh, and I bet they do, because if you need a castle cheap, and it's, like I said, it is a cheap-looking castle, but, you know, same time, it's, you know, its location, you know, but, yeah.
The thing is, I mean, in both the flashbacks, which are supposed to be hundreds of years ago, and the modern day, it's the exact same thing. It's the exact same. First of all, it's the exact same camera setups. It's the exact same look. Mm. They don't try to make it look aged or newer or older or anything. Yeah. It's just, here it is. Boom. Yeah.
This film needed some mist. It needed some filters. It needed some, you know.
let's state right up front. This film has zero atmosphere.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, there's no.
My biggest complaint is this film looks like, if I didn't know if there was some way to mask my knowledge of this film, I could tell you within 5 minutes that this is a shot on video thing because the lighting is flat It's overlit all the time. There's no atmosphere. There is no attempt to light scenes or sets in a way that make them look better or look spooky or look interesting. It's this super flat lighting like somebody was shooting a freaking soap opera. You know, pour the light onto the set and shoot that fucker.
I would go so far as to say it looks even worse than our last werewolf foray, which was Lycanthropo. I think even Lycanthropo had some 90s, very 90s looking kind of things to the lighting and film. I still think it looked better
than this film. This is a step down from Lycanthropo.
Now, did you notice on the closing credits, did you catch the little end? I think it was a nice little end joke on the closing credits where it said filmed in the rolling hills of Visiria. Now, was it Visiria? It seemed like Visiria was from
I don't remember.
When Visiria from a few was it almost
it was in Lycanthropo.
So obviously that was some sort of little instead of didn't want to come out and say filmed in California, so it says filmed in the rolling hills of Visiria. I thought that was pretty funny, but anyway, so
Introduced to the other three members of the crew. It's two girls and one guy.
All film crews look this attractive, I'm sure.
I don't think that's humanly possible. we'll get to these particular characters and actors in a moment, but we're also introduced to the painting of Valdemar Daninsky on the wall, which is quite nice.
It is a good painting.
A very good. I'm not sure what that cost them or where they got it or what the deal is with it, but it looks very good.
It does.
It's definitely a young looking Nashy in the painting, full beard, looking very regal. I like that painting quite a bit. But we're introduced, and everybody's like, "Okay, look, it's late. Let's go to bed." We see that the two girls who are part of the crew are bedding down in the same room, and we have another sex scene. Got to have a little lesbian scene.
Well, one of them makes a comment about, you know, being in a location like this makes you do something you normally wouldn't do before they start getting into it. Although later in the film, it sort of infers that they're. Have been a couple for a while anyway, so that was kind of confusing to me. It was like,
well, when it turns out that the character Leslie, the short-haired blonde, is obviously bisexual because later on she has sex with the cameraman.
Right.
So it's like, okay, well, cool, whatever. But so that scene is pretty pointless. There's nothing there other than, hey, here we go, lesbian scene.
Well, you brought up a good word there, pointless, because here's a couple of thoughts. I might as well say them now. I was going to say them at some point during the course of it. It's good to say them here. A couple of points I want to make. One is that, you know, you were definitely in, you know, Showtime, Cinemax, late movie, softcore, you know, porn
Cinemax
here.
Cinemax After
Dark. All the way down to the music chosen, you know, for the film.
Yeah.
So, and you can, one way, when I was watching the film and I was thinking of the elements, we talked about the elements, and I thought, well, you know, it's like all the old Daninsky films, you know, nudity and gore were very much part of that. This has nudity and gore, but the nudity and the Nashy and the Nashy made the classic Daninsky films was never pointless. Like, it was, you know, if you think about it, it never felt...
Or I would say rarely pointless.
Rarely. I mean, maybe occasionally had something gratuitous. You knew that it was there for exploitative reasons.
Oh, yeah.
But even that, it still normally, I mean, let's face it, most of the times it was Daninsky himself having the sex, but even when it wasn't, most of the times it fit somewhere within the plot or the characters that you're used to and stuff. You know, here, this very much has the classic softcore porn, just sort of where you really literally feel that the script said, insert nudity, you know, it said, drop nudity here, you know, sex interval or whatever, you know, because it just, you know, especially in these scenes between these two girls and then later when, you know, the girl and the cameraman, I mean, it's just like, you know, it really is truly pointless, you know, now, that doesn't mean it's not nice to watch, and that doesn't mean that these aren't attractive, you know, people, but once again, when it's filmed in that way that you've just seen so many times, and that music cues up, and you just, like, constantly, you know, it's just so typical.
It's video porn.
It's video porn.
It's very obviously that kind of...
Yeah.
...of scene.
But the other thing that I want to say is, actually, and this is kind of a praise of the film, is that one thing I do appreciate about this film is that the nudity is real in the sense that these, and it's also really rare to see it in the this as late as 2004. But there, as far as I can tell, there was no silicone on display.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
That these are real bodies. This is real nudity, and that's what I always appreciate, and what I think most people who like classic nudity of films to appreciate is like the nudity of the films in the 70s, you know, whether they were porn films or whether they were A-list films or something, usually got real bodies, you know, you got real human beings. Once you got into the late 90s and most of what you see in the 2000s, if you stumble upon this kind of film, you know, there's just so much implants and silicone.
Pneumatically enhanced.
Like, yeah, that is. So at least I'll give it up to this. I appreciate that Fred Olen Ray is using, you know, real people, you know, for his, you know.
I'll grant you that. And I'm not going to say I dislike seeing, you know, attractive naked women.
Sure.
But at the same time, pointless.
Yeah, yeah.
So it advances nothing.
Right.
If, and here's a good indicator. If you took this scene out of the movie, would it change any story element? And the answer is no.
No, none whatsoever.
It would change nothing that happens in the film. It has absolutely no effect on anyone's actions or any part of the plot or anyone's emotional state, so it doesn't matter.
The fact that these two girls may be a couple or the fact that one of the girls later sleeps with the cameraman, does nothing to affect any of their relationships with each other.
So it's pointless.
Now here we see when they come in and meet here the crew and one thing we see before they all break to get ready to for dinner is we find out that Elizabeth Báthory is there on the scene too, and she apparently is sort of a assistant / maid housekeeper. It's sort of hard to functions.
She's apparently the only servant in the entire castle,
which
is A, unbelievable, and two, a WTF moment of epic proportions. So we're to believe, and a good script could set this up and make you think this is a logical, smart thing, that Elizabeth Báthory has been the maid / servant of the Daninsky family, which is intimated from the dialogue later in the film, for centuries, to stay near to the Daninsky clan for why again? in all seriousness, why? Because to the best of my knowledge, somebody that's got to regularly bathe in a woman's or a virgin's blood to stay young for hundreds of years better be moving around.
I was going to say, won't people start to talk a little bit? It's like, you were at my grandma's funeral and my great-grandma's and my great-great-great-grandma's funeral.
And that seems just an obvious thing that nobody doped out or even... And you're not supposed to think about these kind of things, but in this subservient role, which is, of course, not what you're expecting whatsoever.
Right.
Okay, so how long has she been doing this? And then apparently forever she keeps emphasizing that she's been there for years and years and years and years and years. And I was like, why? But and also the story never gives us any reason for why this stuff needs to be happening now.
Yes, exactly. So, I thought about that too, yeah.
Well, anyway, we have the dinner scene where Mr. Daninsky has a big dinner with the crew there, and they discuss what they're going to be doing and all this, that, and the other. We learned that the Elizabeth, the servant character, is the one who gave Mr. Daninsky this book with all the family history in it. So we learned that she's the reason that they're all there in the first place. She's one way or another arranged this by providing the book and therefore all this information. This is where the Elizabeth actually has the line that she's been here for as long as she can remember. And I get the feeling that there are several moments in this entire scene where the dialogue is supposed to be funny, but it just falls with a thud. It really doesn't work.
It's supposed to be banter between, it's supposed to be a witty repartee, and it's just...
And it flops bad. It does not work. Yeah. So,
and there's nothing to make you dislike characters more than when they're dully unfunny it's like...
Or everybody in the scene is supposed to think that they're witty or amusing, and you're sitting there in the audience going, no, they're a dullard.
Thinking like, I hate these people. Yeah. I want to see them die quickly.
Well, during dinner, the psychic arrives. Our psychic investigator arrives, a woman by the name of Amanda Collins.
And you notice the car she arrives in, and I always like looked like it was...
Well, it's the same car they arrived in earlier, which is this old, this much older vehicle. And I can't remember what kind of car it is, but it's definitely an older car. It's a 30s or 40s style vehicle. And I think it's amusing. She arrives and she speaks with Daninsky, and he's talking about how she came highly recommended, but now that I think of it, I can't remember who recommended you to me. So he's having these moments he knows things, but he doesn't know how he knows them, and it seems like we're getting the sense that these things are being implanted into his mind, to kind of against his will or without his knowledge of how this information is coming to him, which, you know, pretty smart, kind of interesting.
Yeah. I like the fact that her name is Amanda Collins. I wonder if that was a little nod to Dark Shadows, maybe.
Probably,
with that kind of
probably
feeling,
so.
Maybe.
There are a number of, you know, to give Fred Olen Ray, the movie fan, his due, there are a couple of things in this movie that you could point to as nods to older things, such as there's a scene early in the movie where a character's watching, it's Melanie, she's watching the Mad Monster, the George Zucco.
Yeah,
on television.
That was cool.
There's that, I like the little amusing line when Melanie says after that first flashback, she says, "Wow, this would have made a great movie." And it's like, "Oh yeah, it did. It made several movies." And there are a couple of things. We learn here in a little while that Elizabeth, is using this piece of jewelry to hypnotize people, which, by the way, is never explained.
No, it isn't.
Nevertheless, that seems to be kind of a throwback to Dracula's daughter.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that. Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah.
Well, credit where credit's due. That little thing did not occur to me. That is something that was pointed out by our regular correspondent and Nashy fan, Vila Wolf.
Oh, okay, cool.
Vila Wolf penned a very neat blow-by-blow takedown of this film, by the way.
I was afraid you were going to say, like, championed it, held it up as a classic. Okay, go on. I take it we'll be reading that in a little while, right?
It's just that there are some very good observations made.
Oh, okay, good.
I need to link this. I'll probably put a link to this in the show notes. Check it out themselves, because there's some good screen captures, and there's a really nice image of the painting of Nashy, which I think is really cool. Mm-hmm. And there's some nice things in there. There's some really good observations. I'm amused, and I think other people would be as well. But the Dracula's daughter thing, as soon as I read that, I went, "Oh, bing! Yeah, you're right. I hadn't thought about that, but that's true."
Now, should we talk about Amanda Collins here?
Let's talk about Amanda Collins.
It's pretty obvious as soon as we see her.
This is the same actress who played Nashy's wife earlier.
Yeah.
So.
And she's quite attractive, and she's also has a kind of an odd way about her, and all. You know, she's a little bit. But she's supposed to be the psychic investigator, so they're obviously expecting her to be a little loopy, and I'm sure they actually even like that, obviously, because that's going to play better on their show, you know, that she's kind of strange. But she has kind of a weird talk with Richard Daninsky as they're standing beneath the painting there, and they're talking about the legend, and she, you know, she's kind of gives a little bit of the, is it a legend, and, you know, and kind of, like, and she it, believes it.
Like she believes it.
And he's like, "You don't believe," and she's like, "Well, it's not for me to say," you know, so.
Well, the actress's name is Stephanie Bentley, and at first pass through, you'd think that, man, she's just not a very good actress, but then you realize that she's being asked to play this kind of detached person, because essentially at this point she's kind of a ghost.
Right.
You don't know it at first, but that's what she is. Mm-hmm. But she's apparently still working occasionally in film. She's apparently spent a while on Days of Our Lives in the past few years, but only in a few movies. And I've seen none of them, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
But pretty woman, apparently a natural blonde. So that's what she appears in this film as. So that's kind of interesting. But Stephanie Bentley, not bad. Yet another in a long line of doomed Daninsky women. So good for her. Oh well, she sees as she comes in as being kind of introduced. She sees the painting, I love that. Richard Daninsky says, "Yeah, rumor was that he was some kind of man beast roaming the countryside." That's when she gives that kind of, "Not really," or this kind of bizarre left of center lines of dialogue that kind of hint that she knows more than she's letting on, or maybe it's just that she's a weird ass freaky psychic chick. I don't know. Well, Elizabeth offers. So that's the end of that scene. She goes off to bed, as shown to her room, And I love Richard Daninsky is kind of obviously a Daninsky because he kind of subtly hints on most of the women. On most of the women.
He's
not pushy.
Apple hadn't fallen too far from the tree there.
He's not an asshole about it. He is hinting around, hey, if you want some sex, I'll be glad to help you out. So, he's brushed off pretty well by everybody. So maybe he needs to be.
He doesn't have the musk. That's right. He don't have the musk going.
Don't got the musk going on. Well, we cut to everybody in their various rooms. I love Elizabeth comes to the cameraman's room, and I forget the character's name. But
Steve.
Is it Steve? Okay.
Yeah.
She offers herself to him very obviously. Want to have sex? And he's like, thank you, but no. Uh-huh. So she has no luck there. So then she talks with Richard.
Well, before you go that, I do have to say that scene ends with what I thought was the single best line, or the funniest, generally funny, because it actually cracked me up. But do you remember
I can't remember.
After that, like you said, she very obviously offers herself to him, not very subtly, and he passes, and then she closes, which is funny too, because you probably didn't notice this, but she has trouble getting the doors closed when she walks out there. Michelle Bauer, she closes the door. You can tell she kind of struggles with it, and the door, she never quite actually closes the doors, because you can still see her standing on the other side, like the doors open. But we're not going to take a second take, I love his line where he says Euro chicks, that actually cracked me up. I gave him that was a pretty funny line.
You're right.
I'd
forgotten about that. You're right. Oh god. Well, she goes off and talks with Richard, and she flat out demonstrates that she knows all the embarrassing back history of this fella about the fact that he was, he was way past broke when he inherited this place, and that he was on the verge of being homeless when he inherited the place. He's wondering, what the hell are you talking about? How do you know all this stuff? And she says, I know what you desire, and I want to show you something. Well, over the course of, we have intercut these other scenes, but essentially, I'll skip to the fact that she takes him to downstairs in the castle, to the crypt.
Right.
Which, I don't see how this was such a hard place to find, considering the staircase was right over there.
Well, hadn't he said earlier in the film that he hadn't been able to find that?
Oh, I know, I can't find anything. It's like, dude, the stairs are right there.
Right, and there's this huge coffin in the bottom of it.
Yeah, then you walk downstairs, and there's this big coffin. It's like, there it is, dude. It's a big... How hard... Did you not look at all? Did you say you were looking and just sit there and drink? Is that what happened?
I think that's what happened.
Well, intercut with this is we have the hot little blonde, Leslie, played by Beverly Lynn, goes to the cameraman's room, and he doesn't send her away, so they have a sex scene there, so... That's the second sex scene for the Leslie character.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, we see Amanda.
Yeah, she's having a dream, which also kind of gives us basically shows us the end of El Hombre Lobo back in the past.
Right. It's either a dream or a vision.
Or a vision, because, essentially she was, I guess, dead before this happened. But what she's seeing is when they've managed to catch...
Yeah, we see a couple of werewolf attacks on people, and then... Inexplicably and unexplainedly, he's chained to a wall.
Yeah, somehow they managed to, I guess, the angry villagers, angry mob.
They have him chained to the wall and are threatening him. And a kind of monk or a priest with a monk's hood on takes this great big, I'd say 3-foot-long silver cross that's one end of it is shaped into a dagger and plunges it into his chest and kills the mighty werewolf.
Yeah. Interesting too that in this scene, I thought it was kind of nice the way they showed throughout in the mob. You can see Elizabeth Báthory there with the mob.
Yeah,
she's laughing it up, having a good time. But the camera never really zeroes in and never really comes directly in on her.
Right,
she's just kind of part there, part of the mob. But you as the viewer pick her out there and realize that she's there and enjoying herself immensely at El Hombre Lobo's death there.
So then it becomes evident why this is being interspersed in this scene, because then they get down into the crypt, and she's like, well, there it is. There's the crypt of Valdemar Daninsky, and Richard is like, holy crap. I've been looking all over for this, and here it is. That's what I'm thinking in the audience, too. It's like, yeah, it was right there, dude.
Yeah.
Unreal.
Like it?
What is it?
This is the tomb of Count Valdemar Daninsky.
Fantastic. I read about this in the old book, but I thought its location was a secret.
It is. to everyone but me.
Is he in here?
The earthly remains of the master of Castle Daninsky.
Why did you bring me here?
Because of the treasure. The riches. You want them. You want to be rich.
It's here.
Open it.
No way. This is getting a little too ghoulish for me. Why should I open it?
Because you are the last of the Daninskys. Come, I'll help you.
My God.
You see the cross?
Yes.
It's pure silver. Its value is immense. Remove it, and the fortune shall be yours.
Grave robbing isn't exactly my style.
It's your legacy. It belongs to you. Take it.
Wait. This is something that should be captured on video. Let's come back tomorrow with the camera crew.
Richard, you don't understand. You must remove it now.
Why must I be the one to remove it?
Because no one else can know about this but you and I. It has to be our little secret. You're looking at my necklace. You find it quite beautiful, don't you?
Yes.
Now do as I say. Remove the cross.
I love the fact that there are crickets in the crypt.
In the crypt, those friggin' crickets. It's like, it's. I know I kept thinking, like, it's like they're louder than frogs when you say you watch the movie Frogs, and the frogs are like,
well, here's the thing. It's a well-lit crypt that nobody could find.
Yeah.
And the crickets knew where it was. And what I love is that there's only one camera set up in this, so it's obviously some chintzy, an incredibly chintzy set where they could not crank the camera to the too far to the left or the right, or you would have seen the freaking exposed beams of the set.
Yeah.
It's a scene that could have played better if it were, handled better, because he obviously doesn't want to mess with it, and he's right. If we found this thing, we need to film it. And that, but then it devolves quickly, and there's just this leap to, hey, look at this piece of jewelry near my tits. What the?
Okay. Where did that come from? I know this, like.
So okay, yeah. It's exactly what you expect it to be. So he pulls the cross out of the corpse, very well preserved corpse for one that's supposedly several hundred years old.
Yeah.
Oh man! Immediately, of course, we have smoke starting to very cheesily come out of the body, and Daninsky comes back to life as you would expect, and he kills Richard. We have once again a demonstration of the joys of chewing on neck meat.
Yeah, and it's pretty damn good. I mean, I was gonna say the throat rippings are pretty good in the film. I mean, overall, considering how the pacing, the timing of it, and the way that the even though it's not necessarily that I'm saying it's a hard effect to pull off, and it's obvious how they do it. But I think that it rips very effectively. It's a fun bit of groove, a fun bit of gore that
they do
several times in the film, and most of the times it works pretty well.
It works pretty well. Ouch. The cat just left my lap.
She did one of those farewell like kind of launches herself. Launches the way they launch themselves by digging in a couple inches of flesh.
Yes, I'm now bleeding probably, but anyway, we see Melanie and Steve in their room together. And she's looking out the window, listening to wolves howl in the distance. She and Steve talk for a few minutes, and they go off to bed. And then we have this scene of a peasant girl walking along at night like she's freaking Little Red Riding Hood. Now, here's the thing.
That's how I put in my notes. I put, yeah, and of course, the local village girls do all their chores at night, as they always do in Waldemar Daninsky films.
Well, not just that.
I know, but she's from like 18.
I know,
you know
she's
17,
dressed as if she's a peasant from the 1800s, for fuck's sake. What in God's name?
I know, it's just, yeah, it's, I put that in too. It says she dresses like Little Red Riding Hood. It's like,
what is this? Was this originally supposed to be a flashback scene that was to take place in the past?
Well, I see what you're saying. When they originally filmed it, then they later they just used it as a modern killing or something. Maybe, but we get...
Anyway, the werewolf attacks her and kills her.
Yeah, yeah.
And then while this is going on, a hunter who is dressed in much more modern looking clothes...
Right.
Hears this going on and goes over... and sees the werewolf and shoots him with a shotgun.
Uh-huh.
He attacks the hunter, and of course, you know, more neck meat ripping.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's... all I can think of is maybe the girl was on her way to a costume party.
Well, you would think that, except that it's not the last time that we see... I mean, last time we see locals dressed that way. I mean, we get a killing scene later in the film.
Oh, no, we get another scene like that, too.
And it doesn't... like I said, it makes no...
Here's the thought, and this is just what seems to be pretty obvious to me, is they randomly filmed a bunch of scenes like this in period dress with the idea that these will be used as flashbacks to show the viciousness and the attacks.
Well, because
of the werewolf.
Again, I'm sure they didn't have Nashi for use for too long, and they couldn't keep him in the makeup for too long, so they may have just set up a whole bunch of, like, let's film a whole bunch of murder scenes.
Right.
And without, maybe, who knows, maybe they didn't even have the script finished at that point. Possibly.
Well, who the hell knows, but... obviously, they feel like, okay, how much do you want to bet? Oh, God, the film is short. Let's inject a few more of these scenes into the film.
Sure.
Regardless of the fact that these people are dressed like they're in the freaking 1800s at the very earliest.
Yeah.
And it doesn't fit because this scene now has to kind of be taking place in modern day.
Mm-hmm.
But...
I know, but it was maddening. I was just like, well, for one thing, because, you know, at first I thought, like, well, are they trying to pull the old, like, kind of... you know, Nashi old world versus new kind of thing, but since none of the new modern characters ever interact with any of the people from the village, there's nothing there. If that's what they were going for, there's no tension, there's no friction, there's nothing to be gained from that. So it just makes no sense whatsoever.
Not a thing. Well, we have Elizabeth. We have another sex scene this night as well, where Elizabeth goes in to the blonde chick who had the lesbian scene earlier with the Leslie character, and blindfolds her, and apparently this blindfold is powerful enough to convince this woman that she's just having another lesbian sex scene with Leslie, so that we have our second lesbian scene, and then this scene ends weirdly. I'm gonna ask
it
you
does
this
end
question.
Strange.
It ends. We go through all the fake softcore porn motions of a girl on girl sex scene. And then we have suddenly the Christie character like comes to consciousness sitting in the bed, in the middle of the bed, and takes the blindfold off and has this really puzzled look on her face, kind of a look up between puzzlement and horror.
Well, because nobody's there. I mean, she's like obviously disoriented because she's come out expecting there to be somebody there. And so I'm assuming that she suddenly wondered if she's like who it was, if she's just imagined it, if she's dreamed it. But she seems very disturbed by it.
Yeah. And then there's no... And what's interesting is that there's no payoff from that in later scenes. It's not as if this puts some doubt in her mind that she starts asking questions.
Yeah, or that there's any kind of, like... I mean, the only thing she references, like, later, there's a scene where Leslie mentions how weird Elizabeth Bathory is, and Christie says, oh, I'd do her, you know, or whatever. You know, she says that. She makes that just throwaway line, like, you know, I'd totally do her, you know, But there's no between Christie and Elizabeth Bathory in their later scenes. There's no reference back to anything like that. Wow. Almost makes you feel like they filmed the scene and just on the spot he thought, hey, it'd be cool to do this and end the scene this way, and then you know it just sort of didn't really sync up with anything else in the movie.
It's strange.
It is very odd.
Well, the next morning, the two guys, Steve and
Tony.
Go off to start scouting locations. Elizabeth tells them that Richard's not around. He had to go into town on some kind of errand, and he probably won't be back until after dark. So don't look for him to be helping out today. Melanie needs to get into her makeup. They're going to start filming some stuff.
we get this thing with Elizabeth Batory where she looks at, obviously she sees her hand and notices that her hand, I'm assuming, must be aging or something,
yeah,
because she's sitting at the table
wrinkled,
and then she starts looking at
yeah.
her hand. So she puts on a glove and she's been examining herself in the mirror, so she's obviously getting a little bit of a notice that it's time to take a bath. So.
Yep, time to do something about this. Oh, and during this scene, we see Valdemar Daninsky watching from the stairs as they, you know, decide, okay, we're going to go out and start scouting locations, and
yeah.
they decide, yeah, they need to get into makeup. And he's in full period costume.
He is,
with the poofy shirt
and the mullet and all that.
Oh, and the beard. Yeah, it's true.
And these scenes are really sad for me to watch, or really kind of embarrassing for me to watch, because there's too many of them where he's, they're just...
He's lurking off the side, and he's not interacting with any of the other characters, so it's obvious these scenes were shot by themselves when they, you know, the period of time where they had Nashi there.
Yeah.
And he's just lurking around and looking at all this stuff, and there's no interaction. He's not doing anything, and for some reason, he's in period costume, which I don't get, because it's not like he woke up in this outfit that he prances around in the rest of the film. there's no logic there's no internal consistency to what is happening.
Right.
It's irritating. Because it's irritating because it draws attention to itself. And every time you draw attention to something that is not explained by the film, or that is in and of itself a question mark, you draw the audience out of the film. And they know, they're not able to get past the fact that I'm watching a fiction that you have produced and are putting in front of me, hoping that I will... You know, I can no longer suspend my disbelief, and you are taking me out of it, and I am seeing the seams and wondering why the hell I'm watching it.
Yeah, yeah.
You mentioned Elizabeth examining herself, so she gets her tits out again.
Yeah, yeah.
Puts on the black glove. We see Amanda sitting on a bench outside the castle. She's reading. Was she reading something? Was she reading the book? Yeah, she's reading the book.
Yeah, she is.
And Valdemar is watching her from a distance. She sees him and calls out to him, but he leaves. He runs away like a scared little squirrel. Because, of course, we can't have him interacting with other characters.
No, exactly.
We'd have to have dialogue.
That wouldn't work.
the two guys are shooting stuff out in the front of the house. And they're shooting stuff with Melanie, and they start asking, okay, well, where's Amanda? Let's get the psychic chick out here, and let's start filming some of this stuff. Elizabeth, while this is going on, Elizabeth tricks Christy down into the crypt, lies to her and says, oh, well, they were going to shoot outside, but there was something about cloud cover, so they decided to go down here.
Mm-hmm.
And takes her down to the crypt, and intercut with this is actually an okay funny line where the everybody's like, hey, where's Christy? Why isn't she here?
Mm-hmm.
And the cameraman guy says, she's probably chained to a wall somewhere inside. And then cut to the fact that Elizabeth has her chained to a wall down in the crypt.
Yeah.
Got her chained up totally nude.
Yeah.
And of course, she's conscious, so it's not like she knocked her unconscious, so we have no idea how this, it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
anyway.
Well, I assume the magic necklace must have taken care of it.
Maybe so. Well, she, of course, cuts her throat, so Christy is down, she uses her blood to bathe in to try to, you know, youth herself up.
And there was plenty of time for Christy to scream, and you would have a hard, you'd find it hard to imagine that if she screamed that she was far enough, away that anyone wouldn't have heard her. She's right down the stairs in this,
You'd think she would have at least thought, you know, maybe I ought to yell.
Yeah.
But she never does. We're back out with the crew, and clearly they've worked for a solid 30 or 40 minutes, and they're ready to call it a day.
We're supposed
to get the idea that they've been out. And they've been doing stuff all day. So we're supposed to get the idea that the whole day has passed. Them out there filming different things and setting up shots and all this.
Right.
Which is all fine and dandy. Amanda sees Valdemar again after they've all trundled off inside. She kind of hangs around outside as it starts to get dark. Sees Valdemar again off in the trees and notices there's a full moon. And the transformation starts. He starts to transform into a werewolf again. Now, here's the thing. The way this is cut, did she stand there and watch him transform?
I wondered about that, too. I couldn't tell if that's what she's supposed to be seeing or not.
And the film doesn't seem to care. We're not sure if she hung out and watched him change, because the film isn't well made enough to show us that.
They didn't employ a continuity, I think, assistant on.
I think they employed the old hell with it, let's barrel past it, nobody will ever notice method of filmmaking. We see the crew inside the quote unquote castle. Steve wants to try to get footage of the wolves tonight if they come back, so he's wanting to kind of leave the camera up front, which they make such a big fuss about. You think it's going to factor into the film in some way, which it does not. They start asking, "Hey, where's Christy?" And they're like, "Well, she has to be around here somewhere," and they decide to start looking for her. This is when we have another one of these scenes of lusty peasants.
Lusty
peasant couple. Yeah. Out in the woods being stalked by a werewolf. They're being stalked by a werewolf but don't appear to know it, so we have another sex scene.
Mm-hmm.
Nice softcore sex scene between, you know, kind of a Fabio lookalike and a well put together, you know, female out in the night.
Who was obviously out doing her chores at night, as they do, and ran into her boyfriend here.
I'm going to say that I hope.
I think it's hot in those peasant countries there, and you know it's cooler at night to, you know, to wander around and, you know, gather the curds and whey or whatever at 2 in the morning. Yeah. You know, it's
dodging tarantulas, obviously. Well, the werewolf attacks the lusty peasant couple in mid sexual activity, and it kills them both.
And this is a pretty good attack scene. I mean, it's a pretty good. It is great that they're in the middle of their throes and thrusting when they both look and realize that they're about to attack. But I had to name the werewolf POV thing we get is drunk cam, and now I got it there because you know this is when they try to, you know, the couple of times when they're trying to show us his apparently how the world looks to a werewolf, and it basically looks like he's tied on a few and he's got double vision.
So. He's hit the bottle pretty hard and is like, "Oh, I've got to go kill somebody. Is that a bush or is that a, what the fuck is that?"
But I do have to interrupt here and say that this is where the film should have gone with this couple and taken off with them as the main story, because these two, this actor and actress, I don't know if you looked up their IMDb pages.
No, I didn't.
You probably didn't, because they just had this one scene. Out of just sheer perversity, I did. I don't know why. I guess I was just curious as to... Because I was noticing that so many people in this film have made tons and tons of movies.
Right.
And most of them have all been softcore or, like, direct-to-video things. Well, this guy is my new... This guy's my hero, this peasant boyfriend here. Look him up and let's tell our listeners how many films he has to his credit.
This has got to be a record. Villager?
This has got to be a record.
Is it Evan Stone?
Okay, Evan Stone.
Okay.
Look at this man. Now, tell me the number when you see the number of films that this man has been in.
Oh, my God.
962. And the names of some of these are the best ever. I'll tell you my favorites.
He's a porn actor.
Here's one of my favorites. He was in a film called My Stepdaughter Tossed My Salad.
The sixth.
Part, anyway, so it's a franchise. I think you'll see earlier there's one that says something like, "I tossed my mother's salad," or something like that.
I'm more intrigued by Pee-wee's XXX Adventure.
Pee-wee's XXX Adventure.
This ain't Dracula. He's in all those, or at least the vast majority of those porn parody films like American Dad XXX and Catwoman XXX and This Ain't Dracula. And
the girl in that scene is no slouch either. She's pretty much made her living from the same stuff, you know. But 962 films. I don't care what kind
Justice
of film.
Justice League of Porn Stars.
Justice League of Porn Stars.
Oh, my Lord. So, okay, that's Evan Stone. And the girl in the scene is named Monique Alexander.
Mm-hmm.
And she's been in 252 things.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't look the worst for wear either.
Some of them are obviously pornography as well.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them. maybe most of them. You'd rather see a film about them? Yeah.
But in any case, they end up as werewolf meat.
Yeah, these are definitely porn titles. banging bitches.
Yeah, I think so.
Sporty girls, whack jobs 5.
Whack jobs 5.
Splashes on glasses.
I love when there's the numbers after when you realize this is an industry, okay, an industry to itself, you know.
There's like five.
Then we made
14 of these things.
10, babe.
My sister's hot friend, 17.
17.
My Lord. Oh, man.
Anyway. And I bet you those are so distinctive. I'm sure the plots, you know, which, you know.
Oh, please, man. You know, these are... These things are collections of clips, and that's all. You might like one clip better than the other, and that's about as far as it gets.
Now here's something that goes back to what we were talking about a minute ago, and I was looking forward to getting to this because, he you know, let's say we have a pretty good werewolf attack on these two villagers out of the 1800s or whatever, followed immediately by an attack on a girl with a sports car, you know, phone.
Oh yeah, her car is obviously broken down. Yeah,
and she's in total modern dress, and it's a completely modern vehicle. I mean, so there's just it makes no sense whatsoever.
Well, the inside the castle, they hear wolf howls, and so the two guys, the cameraman, Steve...
Not only do they hear wolf howls, they hear our old friend, the wolf howl that's been used in, you know, films since the 19...
Since the Wolfman.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh.
So they hear that, and they take a shotgun and a flashlight, because Elizabeth Bathory is nice enough to actually hand them a shotgun and a flashlight.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And what I love is dude takes the shotgun, and he's like, oh yeah, this'll do. And then cranks a shell into it. I'm like, dude, did you want to check that it's loaded? Or that maybe you want some extra shells for this thing? It is a shotgun. It only holds at most 3 freaking shells.
Yeah, I mean, I noticed that too. He's just like, let's go.
Anyway, so they decide to go in search of Christy, mm-hmm. and head outside. And that's when the random girl with car trouble gets mm-hmm. werewolf attacked.
Mm-hmm.
Amanda and Elizabeth confront each other at this point. This is where Ghost Amanda, who is the ghost, obviously, of
Eleanor Doninsky.
Correct.
They're both admiring the painting again.
And Amanda calls her out.
He was very handsome. Yes, he is.
Is?
I think you know.
Whatever do you mean?
What I mean is that they're not going to find Christy or Richard. Not alive, anyway.
Are you implying I did something to them?
Elizabeth Bathory, you are well known to me. We may drop the pretense.
So you know. So what?
Voldemort died once for me. And now it's time for him to find eternal peace.
I was wondering about you. I thought it couldn't be. But it truly is you, Lady Eleanor Doninsky. Or at least her ghost.
Time to repay an old debt.
Actually, I'm glad to see you. When your husband killed you the first time, it screwed everything up. And I have been cursed unto this domain ever since. If Voldemort delivers up a total of 6 souls to my master, I can move on to bigger and better things.
I'm afraid that's not in your future.
Really? Have you any idea what it's like to cook and clean up after you people? And bathing in blood? I am highly motivated. And now, I'm going to bathe in your blood.
Okay, that's not a bad line. But
no, it's not.
I think it needed another take for her to deliver it better.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Now, here's the thing, and I'm going to take my cue from Vila Wolf's posting about this particular film, because you and I both had that same look on our faces that clip plays out, which is, so now we discover, late in the game, mm-hmm. that Voldemort needs to deliver 6 souls to her master, and then everything's cool. Well, then she's not been counting.
Yes, that is a problem.
Because we've got Richard Doninsky,
mm-hmm.
dead meat.
Mm-hmm.
We've got that random woman.
Mm-hmm. The first villager.
Yep. And the hunter,
mm-hmm.
right after that.
And his woman. Oh, yeah, the hunter. And then the couple.
And then the couple who had sex.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got
the girl,
the stranded motorist.
Right. That's 6.
There you go.
Mission accomplished. What the...
Movie. Yes. Movie. I have to express my desire for you to understand what the phrase internal logic means. Because this is just a basic headcount thing.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
all you have to do is go, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. 1, 2, 3. How about this? Mm-hmm. Fred Olen Ray, I know it was a short film, but maybe you needed to leave one of the bizarre period murders out of it so that people looking at the film couldn't immediately just go, hey, well, hold on a second here. he's like off to shitload of people. Let me count.
Yeah.
Plus, what is the, why didn't we know this?
Well, exactly. Now, here's something I was going to say. Like, some people could say, like, well, you know, we've had plenty of other Nashy films that had convoluted mythologies but he usually at least lets us know pretty early on, and he stays consistent within at least whatever crazy
weird setup he has given you. At least we know what it is, and therefore it follows through.
Here we're like, you know, here we're like 5 minutes from the conclusion of this 75-minute film that we suddenly find out something else too. He's just like, you know, this, what's this thing about, you know, when Voldemort killed you the first time, it screwed everything up. How? Why? You know, how did it screw things up? You know, that's
what in what way? Because
what did she want to have? What was he supposed to do when she turned him into a werewolf? What was supposed to happen? You know, it's just it is maddening. It is maddening.
No, it's this. There's this level of what. There's a part of me that wants to ask Frel and Ray. Was the convoluted, fucked up nature of this whole thing kind of something that you were winking and nodding at the audience about? Those who've seen the other Daninsky films and kind of realize that the mythology is kind of weird and convoluted, and therefore you kind of wanted to have that there too, or is just shitty writing?
Curious.
I mean, I'm good with either one. I just want
to
know.
Yeah, just would like to know. I'd like to know how much of this, like you said, how much of this is like you said, how much of this is winking, sort of maybe even satirizing a little bit, or just offering up a kind of affectionate
an homage, if you want to. If you want to be nice, to those, you kind of say, maybe you could say homage. So that's fine. It's. I've got to pull myself together again before we go on. Hold on.
We're speeding towards the finish line. So.
Yes, I gotta keep that in mind. Hell yes. Anyway.
Anyway, they have a little what'd you say? Ghost versus evil countess bitch fight here. I guess.
Yeah, ghost versus witch, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
We get a lame ass girl fight here, as a Bathory pulls out the big silver cross dagger,
which is the most cumbersome weapon I think we've seen in any.
The way it moves around in this scene, more than obviously cardboard.
Yeah,
so there's no weight to the thing at all.
Yeah. I noticed that. This is like those things you buy in the, like a drugstore, you know, Halloween, display.
Yeah. it's tarted up with a little extra silver paint, and that's about it. During this rather lame cat fight, necklace gets yanked off of Elizabeth's neck, and apparently this necklace is way more important than we've been led to believe, because she just fucking explodes.
I know, and that's what killed me too. Sitting there thinking, okay. The whole thing about Elizabeth Báthory's legend and character is always that she, you know, bathes in blood to stay young. So if her power is broken, what's going to happen to her? Well, obviously, she's going to just, like, age before your eyes. No, she doesn't. She explodes. She friggin' explodes.
She lame CGI explodes.
She does. I know. It makes
And if you think about it, it makes perfect sense if you're drunk.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you're drunk, that makes sense. Oh, yeah, of course you would explode. I'd explode, too, if somebody yanked the jewelry off my neck. Jeez. All right, so then we have Leslie, the hot blonde, the short-haired hot blonde.
Right, because she's kind of stayed inside while Tony and Steve and Melanie all went off to look for Christy. She stayed behind.
We see her suddenly stalked by Valdemar in front of the fireplace there in the castle. And he's coming at her, and looks like he's about to rip into her throat, when the ghost of his wife intervenes and stops him by talking to him. And looks like he's calming down. He comes over and starts coming toward her. But then he gets all kind of fierce there for a second, and the ghost stabs him in the chest with the silver cross.
Yeah, and did you hear the did you hear him whimper? Did you hear that? Oh my God, that was so awful. I was like, no, this has got to be, once again, is this something, is this meant to be? I know a lot of parts of this film were supposed to be humorous. Is that supposed to be a joke? But I swear to God.
See, I don't know, because.
Because they put a dog's whine whimper there in the midst of while she's, like, talking to him.
A part of me that thinks that had to be intentional, and maybe the idea was to generate a little bit more sympathy for this death.
Yeah, well, yeah, I mean,
and there's a part of me that felt, hey, that kind of works, except the scene is shot in such a way that it lingers in other words, if it had been, if we'd heard that lower down in the mix as a close-up right after the stab, you know, a close-up on his face, and you get Nashy getting that look in his eyes that we've seen before when the werewolf gets taken down, where, you know, you're reminded, no matter how vicious this creature is, he doesn't want to be this way.
Right.
I think it could have worked. It would have been interesting, and it might have worked very effectively, but like I say, as presented, it, I want it to work, and it doesn't quite, and it's kind of irritating. And he explodes. No, he doesn't explode.
Well, no, they do.
Hold on. We need to get to that.
Yeah.
I would like to point out again that in this scene, as he turns back to himself, the bad CGI, he reverts to Valdemar.
And her whole last speech to him is pretty good, too. I mean, it's actually, there is some pathos in this scene between the way that they play.
Oh, I agree.
There is some, you know. That's why the dog whimper bothered me even more, is because I felt like there was... You know, I felt like it was some pretty good emotion in this scene between the two of them.
Well, he's back to wearing the bad fake hair and mustache, and is sprawled out on the floor, and goes to his wife, lays down there on the floor with him, and that is kind of touching. That is a neat little idea.
That was fine. Yeah,
I kind of really thought that was. I was like, oh man, that's something that Nashy had not. I was used about to say,
right, but the kind of thing he would love. I mean, the kind of thing that he would totally connect with. Like, oh yeah, you're totally getting the romance of this character. You know, you're totally getting that.
And the horror, the pathos, the tragedy. Exactly. The tragic. The Nashy always loves. Yeah, it's great. But then, of course, they explode.
They explode. There's more explosions than an A-Team episode in this thing. It's like,
I don't know if that's true, but close enough. Did any trees get shot?
No, apparently it's just an alternate, just some sort of weird alternate reality where actually when human beings just, you know, when people die, they just explode, apparently, you know.
Oh, God. Anyway, they explode inexplicably, which is the truth behind every explosion in this film. What the hell's going on? Mm. And what I love is that, you know, the two guys and Melanie are out front this whole time. They don't hear the explosion. They decide, to hell with it. We can't find her, so let's go back in the house. Maybe she's come back. Mm-hmm. They come back in the house, and I don't know where the other two go, but Leslie, the blonde, suddenly appears to have actually gotten bit by
There's a scratcher, at least, on her cheek or something.
And she's magically turned into a werewolf instantaneously and attacks Steve.
Well, already knows it because he says, what happened to you? And she says, something that will change my life, transform me, or change my life forever, is what she says. And then she just bites him.
And roll credits.
And you were left to just sit there in awe of the majesty of what you've just...
And that is the film, Tomb of the Werewolf. That is when the credits start, the end credits start. And that is at the hour and 15-minute mark. That is a 75-minute-long movie, which means that it... With the long drawn out seven minutes of credits are almost it's almost a regular length film. It's incredibly short.
Yeah,
but it's a video. It was shot for video. Yeah. It's padded out, and there are scenes in it that have no purpose or point.
Like you look at the credits. I mean, it goes through a visual showing of who the cast was, and then it does the old roll the whole cast again to expand. And the credits are actually long enough for two complete theme songs, and the credit is how slow the credits go by. Right. Let's talk about that last scene. Now, I'm totally with you that probably for the sake of sanity, people should like forget that this was the last Valdemar Daninsky film and just not count it as part of that, you know.
I can't.
But if you're going to, if that's the last scene of a Valdemar Daninsky film, hey, I don't think it was an ending. It was one something that he had not done before, so at least you can say like it was...
He exploded before?
No. I mean,
This is the Daninsky film for the farm film report.
Well, yes, it blowed up real good.
It blowed up real good.
No, but the fact that it ends with a female victim still cursed and going to bite somebody else is like, we had not seen that before. It's like, if that's the last scene of the whole Valdemar Daninsky legend, it could have been worse, you know, but...
I agree.
But I think mostly people will just kind of pretend that this film doesn't exist.
That's what I wish we had done. No,
Well, people are going to look at this as a bit of fan fiction, is what they're going to look at. You know, it's like they're going to look at it as like, okay, this is like, because there's tons of that way. You don't have to accept, you know, there's a million Buffy the Vampire fan fiction, there's a million Star Wars fan fiction out there. It's like you can read one and accept it as part of the canon, or you can just totally ignore it, and that's sort of way we could look at this, I guess.
And I guess that's really what you kind of have to do because it's an absolutely terrible film, and there's very little in it that I can recommend. It is neat. It's always neat as a fan to see Nashie doing something.
Mm-hmm.
It's neat to hear his voice for the, you know, less than a dozen words that he speaks.
Yeah.
I like naked women.
The nudity is pretty. I mean, the women are attractive. We'll say this, actually. The cast is pretty good on the whole. And that's one thing I'd give it. Now, they're not great because they don't have anything. There's nothing great to work with. But if you think about it, so many of the people in this film had been in tons of films before this, and they were all, of course, direct-to-video, and most of them were softcore porn. But these
I would like to point out that one of them that's not true of, and that is the guy who plays...
Richard. Yeah. And I thought, and Sam, I saw him, I was like, I know I've seen him a million times, and it's because I have, because he's one of those...
He's been in, like, 92 things.
Yeah, he's one of those character actors.
He's popped up in a zillion different things, and he actually is not too bad at all.
No.
As a matter of fact, he kind of... If I was going to say there was a half-decent actor in the movie, he was it.
Yeah.
He's kind of fun. I mean, he's turned up in a lot of different films, here, there, and yon. But what's neat is, I mean, he definitely did his hard work. I mean, a lot of years doing a lot of Fred Olen Ray films,
mm-hmm.
but he was also in a lot of TV movies. He's in a lot of low-budget stuff, and apparently he also did... some General Hospital. I mean, so he's the kind of guy who's like hacking stuff out.
Mm-hmm.
He's actually not bad. I kind of enjoyed his performance. He seemed to be able to strike the right tone.
Yes, he was very comfortable. I felt like most of the cast, even again, not great actors and nothing great to work with, but I think most of them seemed fairly comfortable anyway in front of the camera. You know, I mean, there was none of them that I felt were just painfully wooden. You know, but he was very comfortable in his role. I mean, he very much, you know, he was very at ease, you know, and played the character.
He was very smooth. I never felt like he was somebody who felt at sea with what he was doing. He at least seemed to be able to project a competence
with
what he was doing. And so I actually liked Jay Richardson. I actually enjoyed watching him on screen.
Agreed.
Not a particularly good movie, of course.
No. I think we can all say that, you know, thank God this was not Nashie's last film. You know, thank God he got to finish on a little bit higher note with some things he did after this. Some improvements. So that was nice.
I did enjoy him. And one other little cast thing that's very personal that I would like to say, which is that the actress who played Leslie, the short-haired little blonde, Beverly Lynn.
Yeah.
God, I am lust with that woman.
No. Oh, gorgeous woman.
Absolutely beautiful woman. But here's the thing. Of course, we always at least go through these films twice.
Right.
I always watch one, always watch it once, watch it, and then go through it a second time and make notes. And do my research and go through them.
Which means sort of 2.5, because then I'll do a sort of fast forward, find the clips, doing my audio clips and all. So that ends up being kind of a, I'll sort of half watch the film again just so.
Here's the thing. The first time through, Beverly Lynn, there was something about her that kept tickling at the back of my mind. Like, what is it about her that's making me... I mean, what's drawing my eye to her other than she's this hot-bodied little... hard-bodied little hot thing who's naked a good chunk of the film.
Yeah.
And after... about halfway through the second viewing, it suddenly clicked in my head. Pow! I realized what it was. With that short haircut and her face and her mannerisms, the way she spoke, the way she even delivered some lines of dialogue, she reminded me a whole lot of a long-lost girlfriend of mine when I was about 20. So from a couple of decades, it took me long going through a movie twice to realize, God, she reminds me of an ex-girlfriend. I mean, a lot.
Yeah.
Reminds me of her a lot.
Wow.
And I immediately had to go look her up and find out, well, is it possible that I'm papering over these memories and with something else, and I've seen her in something else. I was like, I haven't seen her in anything else.
Yeah, so it was truly remembering her from.
Yeah, definitely. And
I thought you were going to tell me you found out it was your ex girlfriend under a different name that you changed.
No. That would be hysterical. No, that's it can't be this ex girlfriend. She does not look like that anymore. She definitely didn't look that way by 2004. Let's put it that way. But. It was really kind of creepy. And then since she's the one who turns into a werewolf at the end of the movie, it was kind of one of those things where it was like, wow, I had that nightmare near the end of that relationship. So
Because that scream could have been yours, that guy, Tony's last scream at the final frame.
Oh, it would have been much more horrible. It would have been like, I would have been, I would have been like a little wuss running. Because, that ended poorly. So that was...
As did this film.
Yeah. Yes. Actually, I think this film ended worse. Yeah. Because there's no recovery for this film. But, oh my God. Yeah, so this is Tomb of the Werewolf.
Yes, folks, we do suffer for our art here, and listeners, I assume, will do the same. You know, it's okay. I have to say, I can't hate the film too much.
Okay.
Because
I would like to say good for you.
Because I had a lot of it fun with. It's a bad film. It's a bad film.
It's not good. Yes.
But it doesn't overstay its welcome. I know you were talking about how you found parts of it tedious. To be honest with you. I felt it clipped along fairly well. It would have been awful at 90 minutes, you know.
No argument.
I thought at 75, I was like, it's probably still 5 minutes too long. But I'm like, you know, but I'll give it that. But I assume you're going to ask me for a number rating, and yeah, I'm probably, yeah. You know, like I said, I like the throat rippings. I laughed a couple of times in it. Like I said, the cast was at ease and a lot of attractive. The nudity was good. So I give it about a 3. I give it about a 3.
Right. I was perched between a 2 and a 3.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because there are... And I'm not saying this because there's a part of me that kind of wants to be nice to the film, because there's not much of me that wants to be nice to the film.
And there's probably part of me that did, too, because, once again, I felt like they were trying to affectionately make a Daninsky film that they could also show on Cinemax, you know. So they had to straddle, pardon the imagery. They had both worlds there, so they were trying to hit the balance. They didn't, but they tried. So
they tried. They failed. It is it's a much better softcore porn film than it is a werewolf movie.
I agree.
It's not good on any level, in my opinion. Mm. There's not much there, so. I guess I'm gonna fall to the 3, because when you get down to a 2, you're talking about films that so bad that epic poems need to be written about them.
Right.
And I don't feel that this is it's awful, but okay, I'm gonna go with a 3.
Mm-hmm.
Now here's the thing: the reason that I go back and forth on was it a 2 or a 3? Because it's awful. It's terrible. And I will say this, it's worse than Crimson.
I was going to ask you that. Is this, in your opinion, knocked Crimson from its vaulted spot as the worst film we've done so far? Yeah.
Yes.
Even the fact that it is a werewolf movie and it has gore and nudity more, which sort of, do you still feel like Crimson?
Freaking hideous. So yes, this is way worse, in my opinion, than Crimson. Crimson's bad, don't get me wrong. Mm. Which is kind of why I gave Crimson, I think, a 3.
Yeah, but it at least had Victor Israel, so, you know.
Had some things, like I say, that made me not hate it. But I will say this, here, just last month, I did see a film that I had to end up giving a 1 to. It was so bad.
Oh, wow.
I gave a 1 to it in that vaunted 1 to 10 scale. It was terrible because it wasn't even a finished film, and they tried to pass it off as a finished film.
Really?
Yes, Tales of an Ancient Empire. The much too late sequel to Sword and the Sorcerer.
I'm aware of this film. I've not seen it. I did not know.
It's on Netflix streaming, my friend. And let me tell you right now, it is one of the shittiest, most half-assed things you will ever view. So having just recently seen that abortion of a film where they clearly ran out of money after filming a couple of weeks of it and then tried desperately to find some lame-ass way to try to tell the story through, and I shit you not, lame-ass voiceovers.
Oh, no. Oh.
Shitty green screen with newly hired actors that were going to pretend are interacting with the other actors.
Wow.
And comic book art to give you under the voiceover to let you know what was supposed to be filmed, like a big epic battle or 3.
Wow.
Oh, God. Tales of an Ancient Empire is one of the worst pieces of crap I've ever suffered through in my life. And because that was so bad, I had a little less hate for Tomb of the Werewolf.
Because you were like, well, my emotional reaction wasn't as horrible as that, so this must be a little better in some respect. Yeah.
Yeah, a little better. So, if I were ever foolish enough to attempt to watch Tomb of the Werewolf again, my rating of it might fall from a 3. Yeah. But for right now, I'll go with a 3. Okay. It's terrible, but hey, okay.
No.
holy God. So, what can we take away from Tomb of the Werewolf? What do you take away from it? I guess the question is, if anything. I think you have answered my question.
I was going to say, I'm speechless. Maybe just that, you know, it's not as easy to do Nashi as people might think, you know. Maybe people there's a poetry to his films. There's an artistry to his films that he brought, you know, that you can throw the ingredients in the soup, but if you don't have this, if you don't have the Nashi knowledge of the sauces, you know, the spices, then it comes off as, you know, being rather silly.
Could it be that they tried to throw in one spice that just didn't mix well with the others, which is the lame-ass softcore porn?
It would seem
a natural outgrowth of the other films.
But it's like I said earlier, it was the kind of pointless. It was the softcore pornography kind of sex scenes there. I mean, you know, they cue up that soundtrack, and the whole film comes to a halt for it, you know, and you don't get that feeling when nudity or sex is integrated into a storyline and characters. Yeah. It should not feel like the whole film's coming to a screeching halt at that point.
Well, I agree with you. I agree with you completely. I think there are a lot of mistakes made in this film, and
well, definitely a tightening up of some story elements could have. It could have done some better. I mean, the story could have worked a little better, you know. I mean, they could have done some tweaks here that could have made it. It could have raised it slightly, you know, to a better level there, you know.
Agreed. It's a failed attempt. It's not like we went into this thinking that it was going to be some kind of hidden gem.
No.
I mean, we got surprised by Lycanthropo because I think, honestly, I was thinking that Lycanthropo was going to be as bad as this film.
Same here. We were really dreading that, and that actually turned out to have some things to like about it, and I was kind of hoping we'd get the same experience here. Unfortunately, this came out to be about what you expected from a Fred Olen Ray film, you know. And that's really, maybe that's what you take away from it. This was not a, this did not come off as a Nashi film. It came off as a Fred Olen Ray film.
And if you go in knowing that, maybe, I mean, I went in knowing that and therefore lowered my expectations and still was like, oh, damn. Because what you have there is you have, you know, you start tossing around Daninsky, you've got Nashi in the cast, and you're not using him well. He's essentially a freaking guest star in a movie that his name is above the title of.
And it's only when he's in the werewolf makeup that he gets to shine, you know. The stuff with him is pretty embarrassing. The stuff with him... It is, you know, it's not that he himself is bad, but I mean, when all you do is just show him cowering behind things and just kind of lurking around the scenes, you know, kind of like a weird boogeyman or that, it's just.
I feel that even with all the technical flaws, with the crappy sound work it's obvious they didn't do enough takes of several scenes so that the actors could feel comfortable with the dialogue and the bare number of camera setups and the fact that the thing is lit like a damn TV commercial, and it could have been done better, but it would have taken more money, and clearly they didn't want to spend any more money on
exactly. And then he was just knocking it out at his normal pace and then going to the next one. Yeah,
he did not look upon this as something that he needed to slow down and do better than average.
Right.
He just treated it as one of his average pieces of product along the assembly line and shot that sucker out.
Mm-hmm.
I guess this would be a case where maybe if you were there, it would have been more fun to see how the sausage got made than to watch the sausage later on.
Yeah.
Well, that's Tomb of the Werewolf from 2004. Neither of us liked it.
No.
We don't recommend it to most Nashi fans unless you're really a diehard Nashi fan and you really, really want to see it.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I guess what we'll do is...
take a break and come back with a little mail there.
Yeah,
we got to tell everybody what we got coming up next and all that.
Exactly. So, come back to us here in a little while, and we'll hit the mailbag.
Right.
snow cones, please.
Cut. What's with this snow cone bit? The word is water.
But I want a snow cone.
Now let's try it again. Now this time, stick to the script.
Okay.
Action.
Water. Water, please. So I get water. But where you are, you can get snow cones. Bring me one, will you please? Any flavor.
Well, sorry, folks, if we sounded more and more like depressed the point we went on. Let's pick it. We gotta pick it back up here. We're in good moods. Don't worry about us. It's just, you know.
Yes, yes.
It's just a film, you know. After slogging through a film like that, you know, talking about it again is sort of like watching it a third time, and maybe I think that was a little too much for us. So.
This was not our most enjoyable film to slog through.
No.
So.
No. But anyway, we always enjoy mail from you, and that's where our next segment is here.
Definitely, definitely. I earlier mentioned this. This neat post done by Vila Wolf. She slogged her way through a number of Nashi films a while back and wrote up each of them. Her lengthy post on Tomb of the Werewolf, I will provide a link for anybody who wants to check it out. I recommend going and checking this out. VilaWolf .livejournal.com. VilaWolf .livejournal.com. Go over there, check it out. Worth reading because many humorous points are made.
Yeah, I bet.
And it's nicely illustrated with stills and images from the film. And maybe this is the best way to really experience this particular crappy movie. You don't have to watch it.
Yeah.
I mean, you might think, well, it's only an hour and 15 minutes long.
But you'll want that hour and 15 back.
Yeah, you will. I mean, maybe. Unless you want to see a woman that looked like a girl I dated a long time ago.
Yeah.
I mean, like, you know, nearly 25 years ago. Okay, give it a shot. What the hell? But here we go. She wrote us to when she found out that we were doing Tomb of the Werewolf, she wrote immediately and went, I'll try to do this justice. Yes. You don't treat Paul like a prop.
There you go. That's well said. Well said.
I think he has all of 3 lines in the entire movie, and the rest of the time they have him hiding in the bushes. Seriously. Then she explains that she did a scene-by-scene review of it, and titled Vila Wolf Tries to Love Tomb, Nearly Kills Its Director Instead. So,
yeah, that's well said. Well said. I love that. You're right. You're right. Because, yeah, if you're, you know, it's what like we said, you know, Fred Olen Ray likes to take actors that he supposedly has admired, but it's like, yeah, but then some of the things he does to them, you wonder if maybe he's...
Maybe your admiration is not something to want, to desire, you know? It's like, thank you. I think you should keep your admiration and your skills to yourself.
Yeah. Just come see me at a con. Let me sign a photo for you, but don't put me in your movies.
Okay. We got more mail.
Yes, we have mail. This is from Chris, a good friend. Chris, he says, Rod and Troy, if it's not too late, I have a quick observation about Lycanthropos. No, we'll be happy to talk about Lycanthropos after watching this film.
Oh, God, yes.
He says, I saw this in a subtitled version. Normally with a film like this one, it doesn't matter to me whether I see it subbed or dubbed. It's not going to be a masterpiece either way. When I heard the dubbed excerpts on your show, however, I was truly appalled. What had seemed in the sub version to be a decent, if somewhat routine, horror film now sounded completely absurd and cheesy. The voice acting and dialogue reminded me of what you would hear in a computer game in the early 90s, except extended out to 90 minutes instead of a few 30-second vignettes. For example, the scene with the two jerks in the nightclub really set me on edge. I reacted to them the way I was supposed to, as annoying and threatening. In the dubbed version, however, they came across as ridiculous goofballs impossible to take seriously. I think this film would serve as a great example of the power of bad dubbing. Play a sub scene for someone first, then show them the same scene with the dub track. It will be immediately obvious how poor dubbing can take the film down many notches in effectiveness. As always, keep up the good work, Chris. Yeah, okay, I agree with him there, and that was one that we talked about, like the guy that did, especially the guy doing Nashi's voice in that film was terrible, or just a terrible choice, and it really does, I mean, a film can really sink or swim. It's why to this day, you know, so many people, when they think of, like, say, Japanese movies, you know, they just smirk, you know, with kind of the assumption that they're all bad, not realizing that what makes them sometimes come off as bad is their fault of people who brought them over to this country and were clumsy in their dubbing.
Yeah, yeah, right. They didn't care enough to dub them well, mm-hmm. and as a matter of fact, in a lot of cases, just saw them as kiddie fodder, and yeah. so didn't really, as a matter of fact, may have dumbed the damn things down.
Oh, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
No argument. I used to adhere to the thought that it's better to see it subtitled, because then mm-hmm. at least you get the original performances.
Mm-hmm.
But as you learn as you go along, is that sometimes there are good dubs.
Oh yeah.
And in a lot of cases, especially when you start getting into European trash cinema,
mm-hmm.
what you have to know is that these things were shot with no sound whatsoever, and everything was post-dubbed.
Everything was really in its own way dubbed. You know, even the native dialogue was dubbed. That's
so
true.
I mean, it becomes a question of trying to find the dub that works best, or mm-hmm. just, you know, and that can be. That can kind of be in the ear of the beholder sometimes, and
mm-hmm.
sometimes it gets even more complicated with that, with various different cuts and people, you know, doing the dialogue in one language, kind of altering or changing the dialogue in a certain way to alter the feel of an entire scene, or even sometimes the thrust of an entire film.
Yeah.
So,
interestingly enough, me being, of course, a huge, you know, being such a fan of Japanese giant monster films, Godzilla films and all, there are some Godzilla films that have had two different English dubs. And one thing you'll, because they, in the early 70s, they took some of the 60s, you know, the first earlier run of Godzilla films, and Toho, this is, you know, Toho themselves re-edited them, recut them a little bit, and re-released them. You know, they're re-released over here with a new English dubs, and you'll find that among us Godzilla fans, you know, it's funny to hear people like comparing dubs, you know, English dubs, you know, and actually preferring one over the other. But you'll hear them talk about the AIP dubs, the American International dubs, because that's what we grew up watching, you know, when they show on TV, that's what we hear. And so there were bits of dialogue or things that you grew affectionate for, you grew to like. And then when they did the second English dubs, of course, and with totally new voices, a lot of that stuff got taken out. And so
yeah.
It's interesting to be nostalgic for an older dub, you know, to be nostalgic, you know, it's like, no, I don't like those newer English dubs. I'm nostalgic for the older English dubs. But you'll find that kind of thread going on to people who get excited if they find out that some of these releases that they're doing of Toho films that are coming out with where you can actually choose from both of the dubs, you know, like the most recent Destroy All Monsters Blu-ray has two different English dubs on it. You can watch the AIP one, or you can watch the second one that they did.
In some cases, would it be problematic because the earlier cut of the film was shortened?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's probably
is
it
that
too.
Part
and
of the
it's
problem?
Possible at the time maybe the audio elements themselves might not had access to mm-hmm.
the
same audio elements, and so they needed to make new ones, you know. And it's interesting because they're so different. So they're even different in the English dubs, you know. There's differences in quality, you know.
Yeah.
And you begin to realize that the older ones were, you know, that there was something kind of special about those too, you know. That then they were actually done well, because they were done in the era when people were taking it a little bit more seriously, you know. And the later ones were done.
It's interesting to get into mm-hmm. the discussion with film fans about the intersection or the crossroad between nostalgia and quality.
Yeah,
exactly. Whereas, and I don't know, because I've never compared these types of tracks. I mean, you really mm-hmm, get into this mm-hmm. thing where there's a nostalgic quality to what appealed to you about a particular film and continues to appeal to you as you get older.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe that's not the best way to have watched the film or
right.
to, you know... It's
definitely. Yeah, I can think of all sorts of examples of that. And I know that I'm doing it at the time. Like I know now, I recognize what I'm doing. You know, but subconsciously, you still, you know, you still,
know
but
you mean,
but
yeah.
your heart, you know, you still like, you know, yeah, I know why. That's because it's the way I grew up. Or this is
yep.
what I want. You know, this is why I'm like not making this logical choice here. Or why I'm still, you know, but it's because I remember the part. I remember what appealed to me as a child. You know, what did
right.
So. Or growing up watching
it's a fun thing, and it's one of the subjects I come back to periodically on the blog, because it's something that swirls around in my head, which is just that whole idea of nostalgia as a selling point, but also nostalgia as a kind of that rose colored viewfinder that you carry around with you
oh,
at
yeah.
all times, and I love it, and I find myself in a very strange position, because you always have it's always you always find people who revisit films that they loved when they were kids, and the standard thing that most people go through is, oh wow, man, not as good as I remember. Mm-hmm. That really, mm-hmm. really is not a, mm-hmm. I remember it being a much better film. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, I don't have that reaction very frequently because, I don't know that I was more clear-eyed than average as a child. It's not that. Mm-hmm. It's that part of me can slip back into that mental state of being an eight-year-old or a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old staring at these things for the first time and going, holy crap, mm-hmm. you know, wow, mm-hmm. look at that, or look at this. Or yeah. mm-hmm. I can recognize that something isn't perfect without worrying that it's a problem. Don't get me wrong. I have gone back and watched films and thought,
of course,
I'm not enjoying this as much as I did when I was younger.
Some things don't hold up. You know, some things don't stand the test of time.
But I find it interesting that a lot of people they get really vehement in their put downs of these things. It's like, it's a shame. It's just I go back to it and it's just a piece of shit. And it's like, yeah, but. As a rational thinking adult, before you sat down to watch it 20 years after the fact, did you not have any firm memories of it and therefore not mentally realize before you pushed play that it probably isn't as good as I remember it?
Yeah.
Engage, kind of, you know, lower your expectations. Yeah, kind of prepare yourself for
that, realizing that, you know, we assume you've grown and changed since you watched it 20 years ago, so.
One would hope.
Yeah, you know, so, yeah, when you expect that you're going to obviously be viewing it with different eyes, you know.
Well, see, that's one of the things, and not to harp on a film that's, you know, considered, you know, one of the best films ever made, but that's one of the joys for me of watching a movie like Citizen Kane, is that when I first discovered it said a lot of different things to me. And as I've gotten older and watched it at different points in my life, it has other things to say to me. Mm-hmm. And it's not that it's not as good as I remember it, or even that it gets better as I get older. It's that as I change, the film isn't changing, I'm just seeing other things in it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's bringing out other aspects of what life is or what life should or could be to me. Not all films are built to do that, but, you know, I rarely have that experience of looking back at something and going, oh, wow, that was shit. Don't get me wrong.
It happens. It sometimes
where it really happens with me is with shitty 70s television, sci-fi television especially.
I know. Well, it's like, you know, we've talked about before. We watched it because we had to, because when you had five channels to choose from, if something was horror or a sci-fi, you had to watch that sucker.
Yeah. Not everything could be The Night Stalker.
No.
Some things had to be freaking Battlestar Galactica, if you want to say.
But you watched it religiously because it was on TV and you had to see it. But when you go back and watch them now, it's like, oh boy. it's tough. some of them were hard to... It was not a good time for TV.
I ask you again, why in God's name is Galactica 1980 on Netflix streaming, and why the fuck do I feel compelled to watch it? It's awful. It's freaking terrible. I want to shoot the people that made it.
Yeah,
it's terrible. Why did you do this? None of these characters are interesting, and it all sucks.
Yeah.
But, God. When your big selling point is flying motorcycles, you have given up.
Mm-hmm. Well, like I said, I made it through, you know, every Galactic episode. Even once you realize that you had seen every special effect shot of a Cylon or as a spaceship, you know, that they were going to show the entire rest of the series. You had seen it all in that first 3-hour movie, and they just used them again and again for the whole rest of the series. You still kept watching it, you know, and I still managed to stay through it, like I said, to about the first 2 episodes of Galactica 1980, and that was as far as I could go.
It's terrible, terrible, terrible crap. Well, let me get, we've got another piece of email here from our regular correspondent, Mark, our buddy from the British Isles, or one of them anyway. He says, hello, gents. Well, Death of a Hoodlum sounds like fun in a morally out-to-lunch 70s sort of way.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
It's always good to hear of a new, or new to me, Leon Klimovsky film, as he almost always produces interesting work, often with some nice directorial flourishes. I fully agree with you that Vampire's Night Orgy needs a decent DVD or Blu-ray release. It's definitely in my top 10 Spanish horrors. It has a great cast and a strange off-kilter atmosphere. Apparently the place where it was filmed receives no direct sunlight, hence the gloomy look of the film. I didn't know that. That's interesting. Well,
yeah,
man,
that is interesting.
That's another...
We have to do that sometime.
Yeah, Vampire's Night Orgy is a great little movie. Whilst the UK Paragon DVD release seemed adequate 10 years ago, the picture quality is pretty poor, and I believe that various US releases are all ports of that UK disc. Yeah. Yeah. That means there's probably not a decent-looking print of it out there anywhere.
Jeez.
He says, speaking of new-to-me Klimovsky films, I had the pleasure of buying two new-release Nashi DVDs this month, the first being Klimovsky's The People Who Own the Dark.
Mm-hmm.
Bill at Code Red is perfectly upfront about the quality of the release, as described in your previous Nashi cast, and I found the negative transfer to be perfectly serviceable, with the real ends being the only truly battered parts of the print. And what a film! Interesting to see Nashi as part of an ensemble cast, although not quite as interesting as seeing Julia Salle in a see-through dress.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like that part.
The other DVD I picked up is the UK release of Seven Murders for Scotland Yard, which is exactly the same as the US version, right down to the menu screen. Fair enough if you haven't got the US release, an utter waste of cash if you have. Glad to hear that there is at least one other fan of Murder Rock out there, even if it does hold the record for most annoying songs in a single film. I have to admit, I don't remember the songs in the film well enough. I remember one being repeated a few too many times, but I've actually developed the urge to go back and rewatch Murder Rock now. Because, like I say, that's one of those late Fulci films that I actually like.
I definitely want
to
see it.
People seem to despise it for some reason, and I don't understand why. I think it's a pretty sharp little fun giallo. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know,
I definitely want to see it, yeah, for sure.
He says, plus, the film features the New York City Breakers as a special bonus. Now, who are the New York City Breakers? Why the hell do I not know what that is?
I don't know. I don't know. That does not ring a bell to me either.
Oh, thank you, magical internet. That's a breakdancing group.
Uh-huh, it's okay.
Breakdancing and hip-hop group. Oh, man, is that in there? Maybe I don't want to watch Murder Rock again very soon. Oh, wow. Okay, Mark, with that line right there, you may have placed Murder Rock back further in the to-watch pile than it previously was. Well, he says, looking forward to the next Nashi cast, as Tomb of the Werewolf is almost certainly guaranteed to be utter crap.
Well,
and a bad film generally makes for a good podcast. Prove me wrong, I dare you. Was it a good podcast?
We tried to make it a good podcast. We tried to keep your British stiff upper lip there, but I think we eventually faltered.
Oh,
there.
I shed a few tears, and my lip did wiggle. I have to admit. So yes, no. You'll have to tell us, Mark, if we did a good enough job with this podcast, because the film lived down to our expectations.
Yes, it did. But
thank
thanks
you again,
everybody.
Mark.
Yes, thanks for the mail, everybody. Keep them coming. Thanks for listening. And I guess we now it's time to talk about what we have coming up on episode 31.
We are going to jump backwards. Not much of a way other than we could go. We're going to go backwards in time back to 1980.
Mm-hmm.
At least that's what the IMDb gives for its release date. So 1980... a little more Paul Nashi goodness. We're going to finally watch Los Cántabros.
Mm-hmm. He directed this one and wrote the script.
Yes, he did. Apparently from an idea by Joaquin Gomez. So, should be interesting. It's got an interesting cast along with Julia Salle. We have Andres Rezino.
Awesome.
And quite a few other actors.
I was about to say, it's
Frank Brana,
mm-hmm.
which is great. Like I say, Luis Siges.
Luis Siges, all right.
So, looking forward to seeing this. It is apparently some kind of sword and sorcery thing. I don't know.
Yeah, I have no absolutely zip about it. I haven't read a single word, so I have no idea what it did. But we're very excited to have it on hand.
Yeah.
See how it turns out.
So, Los Cántabros, looking very much forward to checking this sucker out. I don't know what that is. I'm assuming that's a region.
That's what I was thinking. Like, is that what it is? Is it from?
Has to be. So. Los Cántabros up next time for NashiCast number 31. We're looking forward to this because should be very different from what we've been covering here lately. I mean, I guess the last... If this is a sword and sorcery kind of thing...
Boy, we haven't... I guess really the last sword... I guess really... The Marshal of Hell would be the closest thing that would, I think.
That definitely had, you know,
Beast and the Magic Sword. I guess those are the last couple of things we've done that would be considered sword and sorcery.
Yeah. It's exciting to go back to something of that type. Going to be interesting. So, next up, Los Cantabros. Join us for that, if you will. I would like to also say, by the way, if you wish, you can check out the new podcast, the very occasional podcast that we're calling The Bloody Pit. The occasional episode with just Rod, that would be me, and also interspersed with episodes where I sit down with other people and we discuss the living hell out of a film or a type of film or something of that nature. So keep that in mind. The Bloody Pit is out there. Visit the Bloody Pit of Rod, my blog, and you will find information there and the ability to actually play the various episodes right there at the touch of a button.
You should definitely check out our take on Yor, the Hunter from the Future.
Oh, I think everyone needs to check out our take on Yor, the Hunter from the Future.
We had a good time with that one.
It is available on the iTunes, in the iTunes store and various other places, so check it out and hope you enjoy it.
Yeah.
So, remember, you can get hold of us at nashycast@gmail.com. Drop us a line. You can come over and like us on the Facebook page, tell us what you think, drop us strange bits of praise and or, I don't know, curses. Strange curses that don't make any sense that you deliver with a necklace.
Send us a box of chocolates for what we had to do here tonight. So,
or at least a box of tissues as weep for the things that Nashy did in his final years for people like Fred Olin Ray.
And don't send us a box of crickets.
No. We heard quite enough of those going through Team of the Werewolf.
Yeah.
So, folks, we'd like to thank you very much for tuning in.
Yeah, thanks, folks.
We wouldn't be doing this show if people weren't out there listening. Well, okay, that's probably a lie. We'd probably still be doing this.
Yeah, we'd still be getting together and talking films, let's put it that way.
But we wouldn't be recording them and putting them on the internet for other people to listen to. So, thank you for encouraging us in our bad, bad ways of living with life. Oh, wow. We cope with things poorly, don't we?
We do.
Well, thanks, folks. We will see you again for Los Cantabros next time out. I am Rod Barnett.
I'm Troy Gwynn.
And we'll see you soon.